Hi, this is Steve. Since the beginning of the Cinephiles, there is one guest who has probably been requested more than any other, and that is John's partner on the Top 10 show, the brilliant and always hilarious Matt Nost. Now, often with our guests, there's a fair amount of discussion as we try to figure out what kind of film they'd like to talk about. But most of our guests haven't spent the last couple of years ranking their film preferences over and over again. And once I heard that Matt loved the 1988 Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin comedy, Midnight Run, it was a no-brainer. This is one of my favorite buddy comedies, and both De Niro and Grodin are absolutely brilliant. And they are helped out by a great supporting cast, including Yaphet Kotto, John Ashton, and of course, Joe Pantoliano. So, if you haven't seen Midnight Run, maybe you need to take a journey of your own to our website, cinephiles.net, where you can buy the fantastic Blu-ray Special Edition or stream the movie through Amazon. After that, tune into the Cinephiles on Friday, where we'll be joined by our very, very special guest, Matt Nost, to discuss Midnight Run. Trust me, this is going to be a fun one.
Yes! Yes, I lied to you first, but you had no knowledge I was lying about my fear of flying at the river when you lied to me. So as far as you knew, you lied to me first.
Can't even argue with you. I don't even know what the fuck you're talking about.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film, we explore its themes, the history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a voiceover artist, writer, producer, host of things over at Collider and numerous other podcasts. And I say that because
yes,
we have a very special guest this
possibly
week.
Our most anticipated guest of all time, has
possibly
been requested since the beginning of
yes,
the show.
Numerous times.
Yes. We are very, very happy to welcome from the Top 10 show, stand-up comedian and team Top 10 on the Schmodown,
yes,
Matt Nost. Welcome to the Cinephiles.
Guys, that's the best build-up I think I've had on a podcast in a very long time. It's in the top two discussion, you know, that was beautiful.
Do you want to rank your introductions, like the top 10 introductions you've
ever
had?
It's one of those things, you only remember the best and the worst, and everything else in the middle is just kind of, it fades to black eventually, yep, over time.
That's a fair point.
It fades into itself.
Well, we're thrilled to have you on the show, and I have to tell you, so I have to thank you, because my feeling is that without the Top 10 show, there would be no Cinephiles.
Okay.
It would not exist. Because
probably
part
fair
of it, I mean, I've been listening to podcasts for a long time. I'm a big podcast junkie.
Sure.
And so when Rocha first did like the Star Wars podcast and some of those other ones, I started to listen to them. But the one that I subscribed to was the Top 10 show. Like, that's the one where I went, wow, this is really, really great. And I think For two reasons, it led to the Cinephiles, which is, the first is that it really made me go, oh, I could do this. Yeah. Like, this seems
these two pricks can do it, and I know one of them.
I don't think that was exactly the thought process.
It wasn't quite the Sisyphean
task you thought it was. It was just like, this is like a real thing. And then the second reason was because listening to the show, each of you list 10 movies. So maybe there are 15 or 20 movies you talk about in the course of a show, and you devote minimal time to them. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, how could you not talk about this? Why are you not bringing up this? Why are you, in my frustration and all the interesting things about those films?
True.
That's the Cinephiles.
Yeah.
We're going to do one movie. We're going to take a ridiculously long time going into incredible detail about it. And that's it.
And the pattern was the same, though, for Top 10 and then for Cinephiles, because when we started out, Matt and I, and we got this comment today on Twitter as we're recording today, because we've been re-releasing the older episodes.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Someone commented, it was funny to hear you and Matt worry about going over an hour.
Yeah, have a discussion as to what the length of the show should be.
Right.
Doing it on the show. That's how little editing we do. We were having a production meeting on air. Why not?
On air.
Why not, you know?
And it was because at the beginning, Christian was like, you guys got to do 1 hour. You can't go more than 1 hour. So we were figuring it out. We were like rebelling against the idea. And then eventually, once we settled into it, we just were like, well, we're going to do the show as long as we want to do the show.
We did that from the outset.
Well, we did kind of try to stay within the hour initially.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We were certainly talking about it at the beginning.
Well, there was another discussion there. So, like, we came in from day one and the show was presented as X, and
yep,
I remember turning to John and going, that sounds like a terrible show. Why don't we do this? And yeah. He's like, I was having literally the exact same thought.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, oh, we made that change and it made it a show. But what I think we should focus on then, since we gave birth to you.
Yes.
I think I should get, what, 5% of his take of whatever cinephile? That's
entirely discussed between you and John.
Wait a second.
I'm just saying, you keep yours. You do you. But something over there.
All right, I can't get into your negotiations.
But this show did the same thing. This show initially started out, it was like
an hour.
Yeah. And then as it progressed.
Lawrence of Arabia got on the docket.
Yeah.
As it progressed, we realized, Steve and I both realized, and Steve more so than me actually, that he wanted to go methodically through the film. So what he's talking about is it spread as he became more comfortable. And I think that's happened with us too.
True.
It spread out as we became more comfortable. Well, and the fans responded
to the
longer episodes better.
Mm-hmm. Is that they said over and over again, more is better.
Yeah.
You know, and we certainly got. Surely, some point, I'm sure they're going to say stop.
Oh.
I don't know when. People are super pissed when we separate.
A guy hit us up on Twitter and was like, I could listen to you guys talk about your favorite 10 paint, wall paint, like colors are.
Yeah.
And literally my first thought was, I hope it never comes to that. But we've just run out of everything and it's 20 years later and we're like, oh, we got to do it.
20 years!
Paint on walls. What's my favorite paint in a movie?
two things occur to me on that. The first is that, yes, you are very charming and interesting to listen to. And the second is that guy's got to get a life.
It's a hell of a compliment. I'll take it.
One other funny thing is that normally when we have a guest on the show, we ask them, you know, what 5 movies would you like to do? And John and I would like to talk, but you certainly have the advantage, and I've had the advantage of listening to you talk about your favorite films for a few years. And I kept hearing the movie we're talking about today over and over again, which is Midnight Run.
Yeah.
1988, Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin, directed by Martin Brest. This is a great movie and it's one that I love. So it was kind of a done deal for me to do it.
Yeah, John asked and said, hey, what do you think of Midnight Run? I was like, sure. And he's like, well, I mean, we could do Fletch if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And I was like, Midnight Run is fine. I love Midnight. There's a million movies that I love.
Yeah.
It's the reason that we're all sitting in, you know, this tiny little room having a discussion about it. Tiny, and I didn't mean that offensively.
No, it's just very hurtful. Very hurtful.
It's a gorgeous house. I've already gushed over the amazingness of this house.
Oh, thank you.
It's a beautiful house.
Oh, it's spectacular.
Yeah.
Do you remember how you first saw Midnight Run?
No clue. You brought it up. I do not remember the first time that I saw it. I want to say I was probably in my late teens, early 20s.
You think it was in the theater? Or do you think it was?
No. It was rented. Yeah, I'm 39.
Yeah.
This came out, what, 88?
88. Yeah,
something like that? Yeah, I didn't see this in the theater.
Yeah.
I didn't know who, like, Charles Grodin was until years later kind of thing. Mm. Because he was Albert Brooksian on some level.
Yes.
He'd done a bunch of amazing stuff and then Grodin disappeared for a while, it seemed like, by his own choice, then came back and did the Beethovens and whatnot.
Right.
And that's what I knew him as, but I'd see him on like Letterman, and Letterman loved him.
Yeah.
And you're like, there's got to be a reason, because Letterman is kind of cold to the vast majority of people come here.
They loved Grodin. They sunk up.
Yeah, right. Regis, a few other guys, they were just his guys. Norm Macdonald, just loved having all you could tell, the genuineness, and then you go back and see it, and you're like, dude, this guy had talent. This movie, the scene we'll get to later on is one of my favorite in cinema where they're playing the FBI agents in the bar.
So good.
That made me laugh rewatching it for the I don't know how manyth time.
John, you remember how you first saw it?
I think like Matt, I probably saw it on VHS. I remember because I didn't like Grodin. I hated Grodin. His type of humor irritated the living piss out of me. And so I wasn't in a rush to see this film. And I loved it. This is like prime De Niro time.
Yeah.
Like when you love De Niro. And I remember loving the trailer because that line that De Niro has when he jumps around the other side of the train, glad to see me, that always stuck with me. And I used it for years when I was fucking with people. That always stayed with me. So then eventually I finally broke down and I think probably rented it and then watched it. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And when I went back and like realized who the director was, this was a guy whose films I had enjoyed for quite some time without knowing that I'd enjoyed him.
Because
Martin Brest did Going in Style, which was...
I liked that movie a lot.
That's George Burns and The Sunshine Boys. Those three films are the 70s for George Burns, to me, are his prime as an older actor. And I love that. And Going in Style is that remake. You can kiss my ass with that remake. But that Art Carney and who's the guy from Godfather 2? Lee Strasberg. And George Burns. That was a fantastic film. And then he's done a number of films. And then unfortunately, he stopped making films. Martin Brest did after Geely because I guess Geely was enough. And you're kind of.
He didn't just stop. He's disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, he's still alive.
Yes.
He is. Like, because I went and looked, like, well, what is he doing? What happened to him? Nobody knows. No one even knows where he lives. Oh, wow. It's really weird.
Maybe he just
fell off the face of the earth.
And people say that, oh, it's because Geely was such a disaster. But I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's health.
He couldn't find any port. Like, he's just living in Malibu?
I don't know. I don't know.
Wow. That's what I assumed. He's just like, you know what? I don't know if you can curse on this.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Just said, fuck it. I got a gorgeous place in Malibu on the beach.
I hope that's what it is.
Yeah, my wife and I don't need this shit, and just checked out, and good for you. I hope it's something like that. Not he went, Looney Tunes.
He's an interesting cat because, like, he did Going in Style in 79, didn't do a film again until 84 with Beverly Hills Cop. And then 4 years, and then Midnight Run. 4 years, and then Scent of a Woman. Then 6 years, Meet Joe Black, and then Geely, and then he's done.
I mean, it's a weird list.
It's like a reverse
mountain. Weird list.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a weird list, especially towards the end there. The Meet Joe Black.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere. I've seen that. It's whatever.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for me, I told the story back when we did Die Hard that I was working at a summer camp in 88 and that I came down off the mountain, and for Die Hard, without knowing anything about the movie, I walked into a completely empty theater because I like moonlighting and saw that it was Bruce Willis and watched Die Hard completely by myself. And it was one of the greatest movie experiences of my life. This movie came out 1 week later. So it's 1 week after Die Hard.
Wow, what a good back-to-back.
I know, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I didn't see it at that time. I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks after that. I'd come all the way down to San Francisco, and I did the same thing. I had time to kill. I went, I'm just going to go see this Midnight Run movie. I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't totally alone in the movie theater. I was about three people in the movie theater. And that
sounds like
Die Hard experience and the Midnight Run is the best. So I just love this movie. Watched it. This went into the rotation that I watched a lot for the next 8 or 9 years, but I hadn't seen it in probably 10 plus years when I sat down to watch it last night. Mm. You know, it had been a long time, and it still just really makes me smile.
Yeah. And it's a long movie. It's 2 hours and 6 minutes.
Yeah.
It is not your normal 1 hour, 45 minute, 1 hour, 50 minute caper.
Yeah, but they pack a nice bit of story. There's a bunch of different twists and turns. Great little like reveals that they set up, but it's not too overt.
Yeah.
Just to move the story along later on.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit about pre-production. It starts with George Gallo is the screenwriter. And John, do you know what other screenplay he wrote?
I do not.
Bad Boys.
Oh, which one?
Both.
What?
Yeah.
What do you mean both?
He wrote both.
Oh, Bad Boys 1 and 2.
Yes.
Not the original Bad Boys with S.I. Morales and Sean Penn.
No.
Bad Boys, me, Will Smith, and Martin Lawrence.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
That's why he keyed in on you.
Yeah.
You were right to not make eye contact with me for that little plug.
Oh, because of Michael Bay? Right.
And he actually wrote that first, and he was pitching it to Simpson and Bruckheimer. And they kind of went, maybe, I don't know. And then he runs into Martin Brest and tells Martin Brest. And Martin Brest says, what are you working on? And he says, oh, I'm working on this thing. Martin Brest goes, I don't want to do another cop thing because he just done Beverly Hills Cop.
Right.
What else you got? And he said, well, I have this half-baked idea. It's kind of about bounty hunters. He says, oh, tell me about that. And he tells him what he knows. He doesn't have a script. He doesn't have a treatment. He's just been thinking about it. And Martin Brest says, that sounds great. 2 weeks later, I think, he's sitting at some coffee shop, and so four people had cell phones, and so he goes and checks his messages, and on his messaging service, it says, Robert De Niro has signed on to Midnight Run.
What?
And that's how this movie gets started.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
And from a concept, not even a script.
That's my understanding.
Wow.
That's my understanding. And so suddenly you got a movie, and it goes to Paramount. And one of the...
I mean, can you just imagine that? You check your service, and it's, hey, the biggest guy who you would choose. If you were like, you know what, it'd be great, and you're doing your wish list, you're just hoping somebody takes a meeting on this. You get a message saying, hey, De Niro wants in on that two sentences. Well,
except what's crazy about it is that's not his first reaction, because his first reaction is, this is a comedy. De Niro had never done a comedy.
Right.
And so his first reaction is like, okay, and then his second reaction is just as you say, this will be perfect.
Yeah.
He's just straight in most of the scenes. Like Grodin do... he's not really the straight.
No,
kind of a mix between the two.
He is funny.
Yeah.
He is really funny in all sorts of ways. Yeah, all sorts of ways he's really funny.
Yeah.
But we didn't know he had that gear. I mean, like,
Yeah.
And so one of the interesting things, too, is that De Niro went in and read with all the other actors for auditions, which is crazy.
Good for him.
Yeah, which is amazing. One of the people he read with is Charles Grodin. And they just instantly had this great, great chemistry. And the studio said, no way, because they wanted another star.
Yeah.
Because this is a two-hander. And who's Charles Grodin? You're going to put him up against Robert De Niro.
But
and so they wanted Robin Williams.
Oh.
Huh.
So I've had more time to think about this. I'm curious about both of your reactions.
I mean, I think it could work. Maybe not Robin Williams then. Maybe Robin Williams as he got
maybe
older.
Maybe later, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a little more settled in. That's the thing about Groden is older than De Niro, or at least he gives that energy that he's older than De Niro throughout the movie. And I think Robin Williams is still in that, let's do these things.
Yeah, he's still wild.
Yeah, he's still wild during that time.
Well, that's my thing, is that what makes it work with Groden is the completely slow burn, is the is the minimalist slow burn. That's what's working. And Robin Williams is not, that's not him.
No.
Particularly not in 88.
Yeah, it's the gentle pecking that he's doing at De Niro, egging him on. The only thing I think that potentially he could have pulled off better, and it's nothing against Groden, it's just that end scene when he gives him his present, so to speak.
Yeah.
Robin has a compassion in his eyes, but I don't know if he had harnessed it just yet, but he went to Juilliard, didn't he?
Yeah.
Something like that. So I would imagine he could pull that off. It's nothing against Groden, but I think Groden is infinitely better served or serving of the project overall.
Well, yeah, Robin could have done. I mean, Moscow on the Hudson is a glimpse into what Robin can do as a dramatic actor.
Yeah.
And even that weird Survivors movie.
Well, and even like Mathow. World According to Carp. I mean, he has.
Right, yes, absolutely.
He had that gear to some degree. But and the other person, and this one is even crazier, the other person Paramount wanted was Cher.
Cher? No.
Wow, that's terrible. I hope that person got fired.
Because it was right after Moonstruck. She just won the Oscar.
Yeah, I don't care.
No.
Yeah, I don't care.
No.
And the screenwriter's reaction was, we can't have Robert De Niro saying, I'm going to beat you in the head and stick you in the toilet or something like
that. Yeah, exactly.
To Cher. It doesn't work. So Brest goes to Groden and says, we need you to do a screen test. We gotta prove to the studio that you can do it. And the way that Hollywood works is that if you're going to do a screen test, well, then you have to write up a contract. You don't do the screen test until you have locked in what your pay is going to be.
Wow.
That's how it's going to work. And so Groden says, sure, I'll do it. And he basically asked for four or five times the highest amount of money he's ever gotten. And the studio goes, no way. We don't want this Groden guy. You have to do Robin Williams. That's it. And Martin Brest goes to Universal, leaves Paramount, calls up Groden and says, listen, if you don't have to do the screen test, will you do it for a lot less money? And he went, oh, yeah, sure. And that's why they take it to Universal. And that's how the movie gets made. Yeah.
How much did he get?
It's not listed in my notes. Okay. I don't have that piece of information. And that's pretty much all the pre-production I have. You want to get into the movie?
Sure.
Yeah.
That was fascinating. I like that.
It starts with De Niro going into some building, goes up to pick a lock, drops something on the ground.
Yeah.
Which is fortunate because the next thing that happens, a shotgun blast goes through the door.
Shit.
And that dropping something on the ground saves his life.
Yeah.
Kicks in the door. Guy's running away. Goes out the fire escape. He goes out the fire escape after him. Just misses another shotgun blast. He runs down the stairs. The other guy goes down the fire escape into the alleyway. He sees De Niro again, fires again, and just as he's running down the alley, a car comes up and driver's side door opens, knocks him down, and there we have John Ashton, Marvin Dorfler.
That's a great name.
I love John Ashton in this movie. He is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was this thing like, what is he going to do after Beverly Hills Cop? And of course, Martin Brest had directed him in Beverly Hills Cop. So you have that, what's he going to do? This is a great role for him.
Well, and he says after Beverly Hills Cop, he was just typecast.
Yeah.
People just saw him as Taggart, and nobody wanted to do anything else with him. He's like, that's not me. I'm a character actor.
Yeah.
So he was thrilled to get this.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And this is his story about auditioning. So both he and Joey Pants say that both of them went into the auditions and knew that they had to read with De Niro. And all the other actors in the room are freaking out.
Yeah.
And both Pantaleone and John Ashton say, we didn't really care. John Ashton goes into the meeting with De Niro. And immediately, Martin Brest and George Gallo, screenwriter, they go, oh, we have to step outside for a minute, which Ashton thinks was planned. He thinks that they did this with everyone to just leave him in the room with De Niro.
De Niro.
And they chatted, and then the actors come in, and they're about to do the scene, and De Niro reaches over to hand something to John Ashton. Just as Ashton's about to grab it, De Niro drops it on the ground in front of him. And Ashton looks at De Niro, who clearly dropped it on purpose, and went, fuck you. And De Niro went, fuck you. And then they fuck you'd at each other for a while. And then they read the scene and it was perfect. And Ashton walks out the door and De Niro goes, I want him.
Oh, wow.
And apparently he had dropped something in front of every actor. And all the other actors have said, here, let me get that for you, Mr. De Niro. And of course, that's not what he wanted.
Yeah, no, that doesn't play into the character because there's a commonality in what they do, but at the same time, it's they're rats.
Yeah.
Just clawing at the same piece of meat.
Which is exactly what you see in this scene.
Back off, goddammit! I said I'm taking him, all right?
All right,
this guy's worth $1,200.
Okay, Marvin, what the hell are we fighting for? We're friends.
Hey, nothing personal, Jack, but fuck off, all right?
Take it easy. Jesus.
Marvin Dorfler is another bounty hunter, and he wants to take this guy in, and he's now got the jump on De Niro's character, which is Jack Walsh, and then De Niro does this, you know, look over there, Marvin looks, he punches in the face, steals the car, grabs the guy, says thanks for the car, and cue music, cue titles, we are off onto Midnight Run.
And also they plant something, the door trick.
The door trick
that Dorfler is going to use throughout the whole movie.
And the look planted. Over there.
Yeah, exactly.
And
the look both over there. Within the characters.
Right.
Plus on the introduction to De Niro, that kind of shows you what the character is. He's got skill, but just like all of us, he will make a mistake here or there, but he's also lucky.
Yep.
And it takes a little bit of luck to be good at this type of job.
Absolutely. And we get the music starting, which, by the way, this is Danny Elfman. This is one of my favorite scores of him.
Pure 80s.
Oh,
it is
pure.
It's the same as like that little slap bass of boom, 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 beep, beep, boom. And just like, that's synthesized on top of it's fantastic. It's very Beverly Hills Cop. It's very few others from that era.
I don't know. I love it. It makes every time maybe it's because I watch the movie so much. Every time that music comes out, I just start smiling.
It means a good time is coming.
De Niro delivers this guy to the cops. I love the moment where the cops say, "Did he give you any trouble?" And De Niro goes to the guy, "I don't know. Did you give me any trouble?" And the guy goes, "Fuck you, man." off to Moscone bail bonds.
Oh yeah,
where we meet Jerry and Eddie, Joe Pantaleone.
By the way, do you recognize Jerry?
No,
Jerry is the accountant in Untouchables.
Really?
Yep, that's the guy
really?
He has to save. With the glasses,
yeah,
that's the guy he has to save in the Untouchables.
Wow, I can't even put the two of them together.
Yeah, does it? Yeah, that's amazing.
That's why I'm in the Schmodown, people.
It's like, do you guys watch?
It's not for your charming personality.
No,
Billions and the Americans.
I saw the first season of Billions.
Okay, so Dollar Bill, bald guy,
yeah,
loud, abrasive. He is the preacher on the Americans.
Mm, really?
Yeah, and I can't unsee it, but the preacher's like. Oh, with the hair, the P, totally. It's the same actor, but it's just giving, he creates two completely distinct different characters.
Yep. That's amazing. And we go in, De Niro wants to get his money because Pantaleone's the bail bondsman. He says,
"Ooh, Boucher, good score, Jack. 900, right?
No, it's 1,200.
No, 9.
That's 1,200. Come on.
No. Yeah, you're right.
The arguments between Joey Pants and De Niro are great.
Yeah.
He stands right up to De Niro. Like, at certain times, you got to hold your own. You can't back down for the intimidating actor.
I think you always have to hold your own. Because you'll win it more times than not, right? I mean, why would you want to be the kowtowing person that has to work with a guy like that
the
for
role
3 months?
Called for it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he says, "No, I want to go out and take you out to breakfast and have a conversation with you.
I want my $1,200.
And they go off to.
I'm not hungry. I'm going to take it to lunch.
I'll get that $1,200 first. I'm not good for it. That's the other thing with Pedro. Yeah. Every time he comes back in the frame, I never trusted that guy. Just like he's always just keeps squirming around to survive.
He's a certain kind of character.
Yeah.
And they go off to. It's so funny because they went off to this place. I remember living in the Bay Area and looking at this weird place they were eating at and going, "What is that place?" And I lived in L.A. for 10 years before I found it, you know, and it's Grand Central Market, which is now.
Oh, yeah.
It's now like the hip, hottest, coolest.
Yeah, I've
all
been
the,
down there like five times.
Yeah.
Times to eat.
It's a cooler place downtown. Yeah.
And they start to have a conversation where Eddie asks Jack if he knows about Jonathan Mardukas, the Duke. And of course, Jack knows about him. He's the accountant who embezzled a whole bunch of money from Jimmy Serrano. It was a big mob guy. He gave it to charity. And we get a really cool, important plant, which is...
Isn't Serrano the guy that ran you out of Chicago when he was running things back then?
He didn't run me out.
Yeah, right. You give up being a cop to do this shit.
And we get, there's something sort of important about this. And it ends up, we find out that Eddie bailed out Mardukas. And if we don't get him, then Eddie's going to be out $450,000. And he wants... De Niro to go out to get him, offers him $50,000. De Niro says no, $100,000 and a contract, and I'll bring him back.
So how does this work, this bail bonds thing? I'm always confused. Why are
they
paying...
Wait, you've never had to do a bail bond?
No, I've never had to do... But he's like, did they bail him out and then he escaped? Is that what happened? So they got to bring him back?
Yeah.
How did that? They bailed him out for $450,000, whoever bailed him out, and then he ran out. And so Joey Pants bought the bail from whoever had bailed him out initially?
No. Joey Pants bailed him out.
Okay.
He's the bail bond.
Oh, and then the Duke snuck away or gave him the slip.
Right. Oh. So, which is weird because Mardukas has millions of dollars. So why he needed to use a bail bondsman, I don't understand. Because what a bail bondsman is like, you get arrested. They say, we need $10,000 bail. You don't have $10,000 in cash. Yeah. You go to a bail bondsman. He says, I'll pay the $10,000 after you go to trial. You get the 10 grand back, you're going to pay me 11 grand. And that's how he makes his money. Wow. Yeah. So it's a loan.
Okay.
But if you skip town, then the bail bondsman is out of all his money.
Right.
And then we have to hire a bounty hunter.
It could be because he can't show the liquidity of the money that he stole. The bail bondsman is saying, I know you have it, so I'll front you the $450,000, which means what? His bail is $4.5 million? Something like that?
Yeah. It's 10%, right?
Yeah, it's 10% usually. So maybe that's it. Yeah, they never gave a backstory as to why on that. I didn't care.
And it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter.
Fair.
All we know is that he has to get Jonathan Mardukas back to Los Angeles within a certain amount of time to get his 100 grand. So he goes off to the cops. He goes, has somebody there. He looks into some records. He finds that, he made this call to this phone number, and it's in New York. I guess I'm going to New York.
Yeah, it was the only call that he made.
Yep.
Like, as soon as he got out or whatever, he got brought in, that was the call that he made. Just like, I will go there. That's his most trusted person.
Right. He walks out of the police department, and who should walk up but Yaphet Kotto.
Yeah!
He's so great in this movie.
Unsung hero of the 70s and 80s.
Yes.
As an actor, Yaphet Kotto. Never not good.
Yep.
Always great at playing these different parts. More emotional than you think. And subtle as fuck when he's doing his work. And it is so fun to watch. One of the great character actors to ever walk the earth. I just love Kotto to pieces.
And this is my favorite of him.
Mm-hmm.
He is so funny.
Yeah.
And there's so much going on with him. And he says, too, like, no one offered him comedy.
Right.
Well, because he was Alien and, Dr. No and all these heavies in all these intense roles, which he said he liked doing, but he loved doing comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's got a bunch of FBI guys and they grab Jack and they put him in the back of the car. They all have sunglasses on.
Such a great
thing. This introduces one of our other running gags is the sunglasses. By the way, his name is Agent Alonzo Mosley.
Alonzo Mosley, FBI.
Oh, that's a nice badge. How can I get one of those?
It's
going to come up a whole lot. And they ask if he's going after the Duke. No, he's never heard of him. And what we find out is they've been working on the Serrano case for 6 years, and they need the Duke, and that they don't want anybody else to interfere with him. And as they're kind of lecturing De Niro on this whole thing, what does he do? He puts on his sunglasses. Alonzo takes them off, and De Niro, this is where I say he is funny.
Can I ask you something? These sunglasses, they're really nice. Are they government issued, or do all you guys go like to the same store to get them?
And they kick him out of the car. And I love that as he's out of the car, they toss him the sunglasses, and he does a great little juggle to get them. And then, says, thanks for the sunglasses.
Now, do you think that was the intention was for him to catch it and he's playing the cool character, or the intention is actually, that's what I think, and it fumbled, and I think it works better for the character.
Absolutely. That's what I think, too.
Because you see that he almost steps on the glasses, and you see his honest reaction of, like, trying to
yank. And he's right near the moving car, too. Yes. I think it is a great, he uses it and turns it into a great moment.
Absolutely.
And of course, what's the other thing that he got from Agent Alonzo Mosley?
His badge.
His badge.
Yeah.
And he has that great, which was in the trailer, the turnaround badge flash moment is awesome. He gets on a plane. What's he doing? He's got a little couple of photos of himself, cutting them out, making a new badge.
I love how he's just blatantly making a fake ID.
An FBI
on a plane, in front of a kid, and like stewardesses could be walking by, but it doesn't matter.
And the kid is watching the whole thing, and finally he shows it to the kid. The kid's like, I think it looks fine.
Yeah, you did a good job.
Yeah, nice work. He gets to the airport, makes a couple calls, gets an address, and then some wise guys come up.
I'll make it short and sweet. People I work for, really interested in your visit here.
Oh, yeah, who are the people you work for?
An old friend of yours from the Chicago days.
These two guys.
These two morons. Tony and Joey. And they, and what we get is you know, Jimmy Serrano is interested in these guys. You get $1 million to turn the Duke into Jimmy Serrano.
What's fascinating about this movie is that you have point people in every organization that's involved here, and then two idiots.
Yes.
Because you have De Niro is the bail bondsman, then you have Pants and Ashton, who in essence are the two idiots. Yaphet Kotto, he has two idiot FBI guys who are behind him, helping him, the bald dude and the other dude with the curly brown hair.
Yeah.
And in this situation as well, you have Dennis Farina, and then you have these two idiots bumbling around trying to do things. So that's what helps the comedy, is that you have these tent poles, and then you have everyone else around acting the fool, and it helps you to stay not too serious throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
It's great.
It also gives gravity to those people that are above them.
Yes, yes.
So when they do finally interact with characters, there's weight within those scenes.
Yeah.
So you fear them a little bit, as opposed to the two bumbling idiots where they're... I love the shadow boxing scene.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
That is so good every time, because he's on the phone. He's like, what are you fucking...
Because that's what happens with two guys, right? The two dumb guys are fucking around.
This all the time.
Dipshit that is just muscle. And he's just... The guy's like, literally, oh, it's... That's such a real scene of,
yeah.
You would hope he would understand, we don't need to be doing this right now, but at the same time, he does seem like he'd be dumb enough to not care.
Yep. Those little moments that decorate this film throughout.
Well, this is throughout the whole film. There are all these little details, little character moments that weren't necessary, but are great.
Hopalong Scappadooch? What did he call himself? It's like, I don't even know what that means, but I like that line.
And they, you know, they say you change your mind, that gives him his phone number on a little matchbook, which is very important later on. We go off to a brownstone. He watches a woman go into the brownstone.
Oh, wait, sorry, Steve. I don't want to cut you off. But that scene's important. This scene's important, their interaction, because we get the behind the scenes on what, a little more behind the scenes about the fact that De Niro didn't play ball with this guy.
Yeah.
And that's why
he got a previous relationship.
Yeah. That's why he got ran out of Chicago, for lack of a better phrase, because he didn't play ball with these two guys' boss, which we don't know yet who it is yet, right. The actor yet. Yeah. So you get this idea. So he takes the thing. He takes the thing and he says, tell Jimmy I said hi or whatever. And he goes, we'll do that. And so there's already a relationship here established of where they feel they're above De Niro, like they're squeezing a guy. And De Niro now is in a different situation having this come up.
Well, they do such a great job in this movie of giving out little bits of information. Yeah. Like, because we had Joey Pants say, isn't he the guy who ran you out of Chicago?
Right.
And now we have them saying, you should take this money, and we get the sense of the previous relationship.
Yeah.
We get little bits of it as we go along until we get the full reveal later on.
Yeah.
So he's got a old-style tape deck and some kind of electronic equipment, and then he goes off to a phone booth, and he calls into this house. A woman answers. He introduces himself as...
Alonzo Mosley, Federal Bureau of Investigation. How are you this afternoon?
We're going to hear that name a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know why he wouldn't change the name, but he does it. And he says, we see that you were the first person that got called, and we need you to come down to the FBI office and answer some questions tomorrow morning. Just ask for Alonzo Mosley. He gets off the phone. He runs back to the car, turns on the tape recorder just in time to hear a phone call with the beeps, the tones, mm-hmm. to another house where a woman answers the phone. And then who gets on the phone but Jonathan Mardukas, the Duke, and says, get off the phone.
Yeah.
They hang up. He replays the tape deck, and there he has the tones, and now he knows where the guy lives. I love stuff like this in movies.
Mm.
It's fun. I like watching how... Now, I don't know if any of this really works, but it's fun to watch.
I remember, who was it? They got a toy out of a cereal box, and if they played specific tones, they got free long distance.
Yeah.
If you did it into the receiver of a phone.
What?
Somebody out of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it was Captain Crunch.
Yeah, it was Captain Crunch. That's what I thought it was, but 100%. They gave you this little, tiny, little harmonica-looking thing. And if you played like three or four specific tones out of it, that was the computer code to let it know free access to all long distance. So they were making international calls. They gave it out to friends.
This is literally the beginning of Apple computers.
Wow.
Yeah, because it's Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs who know this guy. Yep. And then they build, I think they called it a blue box or a yellow box or something like that.
No clue.
And this was the first thing that Wozniak and Jobs sold together, was a little device to hook up to a phone and get free long distance anywhere. They called the Pope.
Did they really?
Yeah. Wozniak and Jobs called the Pope.
Did they actually get, how far did they get through? Did they get to his secretary?
My understanding is they got into the Vatican, but I don't know if they got that much.
I don't know. Can I speak it to the Pope?
Wait, does an Italian accent help you talk to Italian?
I don't know. I'm asking. I've been to Rome. It may help a little bit.
What I would love it if there was shadow box. One was shadow boxing, the other one after making the call.
Think Wozniak and Jobs were shadow boxing. I don't think that was their relationship.
Stop it! I'm trying to call the Pope.
Well, I can see Jobs just because he's so rail thin, which means he's a hyper dude. So he could be like the hyper one. Wozniak is just sitting there like a totem pole, not moving.
Hey, leave me alone, God! Stop. But we digress. He pulls up to another house, looks around, gets out that trusty lockpick, goes inside and starts sneaking through this house. There's something weirdly intimate about him walking through this place and you see people moving around.
Yeah. He's breaking an entry.
This is not a good thing. We're already not feeling good about it. And then here comes a dog. That barking dog backs him up into a bathroom, is barking and clawing at the door, and out comes Charles Grodin. He kills it in this part. He is so great. Mm-hmm. And they open up the door, and there's De Niro in the shower, behind the glass, flashing the FBI badge, gun drawn.
Last of the FBI, you're under arrest. Get this fucking dog out of here. Get the dog out of here, ma'am.
This is a great opening.
It's also interesting, too, because later on they have a discussion about who did what to who first.
Yes.
And that is actually De Niro, then. He is now the first, because he's representing himself as not, and you're
he
like
lied to him first.
Yeah, it's like when you get later on, be like, well, technically De Niro, when you guys first met, lied to you on the from you're the jump. Right.
That's a great point. Cuffs him, grabs him in the car, and immediately Grodin goes, something's not right.
You work for Jimmy Serrano, don't you?
I don't work for that piece of shit. Your bail bondsman hired me to bring you back to L.A., and that's what I'm doing.
I got money, you know.
I'm sure you do.
I'll give you whatever you want.
Stop by shutting up. I know you all of 2 minutes, and already I don't like you.
See, that's too bad. I really like you.
Well, especially from Grodin's character's perspective of, maybe if I can charm this guy, I can get out of here.
Yeah.
So that his has to be from charm perspective from the moment they see each other.
Well, what's weird about it is that he's so underplaying everything emotionally. Mm-hmm. He's not going like, he's poking at him to get a rise out of him a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. But from a calm place. And as he talks later
very
on,
very calm.
De Niro's character only has two settings, silent and rage.
Yeah.
So if you come in anywhere between that threshold, you can permeate his shell.
They get to the airport, and, you know, we sort of, he's got him cuffed, and he says, look, I can't take you cuffed on the plane, but if you fuck with me, I'm going to break your neck. And Grodin goes,
I can't fly.
What?
You heard me, I can't fly.
No, you're going to have to do better than that, pal.
No, I don't have to do better than that, because it's the truth. I can't fly. I suffer from aviophobia.
What does that mean?
I can't fly. I also suffer from acrophobia and claustrophobia.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you don't cooperate, you're going to suffer from fistophobia.
Calls Eddie up and says, I got the Duke.
Got the Duke? Jerry Walsh got the Duke!
And he says, I'm on a plane. I'm going to be back here, 6 hours, and I'm going to bring him to you. And Jerry is listening to this call. Some guys in a van outside are listening to the call. And then Jerry puts down the phone and says,
this calls for a celebration.
I'll get some donuts.
He walks out to go make a phone call because he's an informant. And of course, Alonzo is finding out because the guys in the van are FBI guys.
He's literally dropping a dime.
Yep. He's literally dropping a dime.
Depending on what the call cost of a call is at that point.
Yep.
Is it still a dime, you think, in 88? What do you think? I don't
know. Like a quarter.
You think it was a quarter by then?
I think so.
Okay.
I don't know.
I don't know. It was a long time ago.
I don't know.
Because I remember seeing the 5-10-25.
Yep.
I remember seeing that.
But at what age did that transition? I don't know.
It's a good point.
I really feel like I've let down the cinephiles, that I don't have this information.
You don't have arcane information that has nothing really to do with this?
I have a long list of notes, but that is not it's not among them.
Let it be known that he just turned around his iPad to show us all.
Yeah, well, I'm calling you research suspect then. After you put in 17 hours on that, you couldn't give an extra hour for all the little details you didn't think about?
Well, this is why I had to have you on the show, because I knew we needed to up our game, but I didn't know exactly
Yeah, feel good. It's good.
And now I know that it's actually coinage and prices from whatever era.
Boom.
Next time you're on the show,
you're welcome.
If you come in and we do an ancient Egyptian epic, I will be able to tell you exactly how much.
What, Stargate? What's your ancient Egyptian?
Is it an ancient Egyptian epic?
They go back to the time travel. They go to actually, what is it, a different dimension or something?
Yeah.
So now Alonzo and the FBI knows that he's in New York. The mob knows that he's in New York. They both know he's on a plane, that he's going to get back to L.A. And we go to Las Vegas, and we meet Jimmy Serrano, which is Dennis Farina.
Yeah.
He's just the perfect, perfect mob boss casting.
And this is for anyone who's listening, who's an actor in their later years, maybe. Farina's a case study. Farina was a cop for like 20 years, 23 years, and then became an actor. And so he slid into these parts of playing a mafia guy or playing a cop so easily because of his experience on that side of the force.
But you know, the story that I heard is he got a start. He was a cop in Chicago.
Yeah.
And De Niro was shooting a movie, and he managed to get himself on basically chauffeur duty.
Yeah,
no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I believe that's what got him into Hollywood side of acting.
Mm-hmm.
Was that he was waiting. He was an actor, but also a cop, and got that gig, and then it blossomed from there. So the fact that they're working all these years later, I believe that's a story.
Yes.
Right. It makes it,
that's awesome.
Their scenes even all that much better, especially the closing ones in the airport.
And the airport is great.
Yeah, and they just, you can see, like, look, I believed in you back then. You're holding your own in this scene. Like, you're an amazing actor. It's incredible to watch.
Yeah.
And they really wanted him, and he was making a Crime Story at the time, show.
God damn it. I never
watched it.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Michael Mann produced Crime Story. It was fantastic. Farina is a Vegas cop in the 50s trying to track down this Vegas gangster. I think his name is Tony something, the actor. I forget Tony something. But he in the whole thing is him trying to track him down, trying to get him in trouble, trying to turn him into to the feds, everything like that. Stephen Lang's in the show. Mm-hmm. He plays a lawyer who's initially on the side of Dennis Farina throughout the whole show. And then he finds out this dirty shit that Farina did. And he said, if you can break the law and he can break the law, then I don't need to follow the law. And he becomes a mob lawyer and he goes on Tony's side for the second season. And then they get caught in the nuclear bomb explosion that they're testing out when they were testing out the nuclear bombs. It is such an insanely awesome, crazy show. But and it did the song Runaway from Del Shannon. They used that as the theme song. It's a great Michael Mann TV show. That's all I'll tell you.
So the reason that it would only make sense that Jimmy Serrano is a mob boss from Chicago. So naturally he's in Vegas.
Right.
Which makes no sense at all. The reason he's in Vegas is because he's literally shooting Crime Story at the same time.
Oh.
And the only way they could get him was to film Midnight Run, his parts in Vegas.
Totally makes sense.
I always just took it as he's formerly in Chicago. Yeah. Now basically we need to run shit in Vegas.
That's what I always took it
shifted.
To.
Yeah.
It made perfect sense, but it's actually just because of production. Huh. We're on the plane. First class is nice.
Uh-huh.
I can make a habit of this. You get some champagne. He's looking at the menu. I remember my wife was on a production in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I flew out to meet her and flew out coach. And then we went to fly home. And because of the production, we got to fly home first class.
Nice.
And I'd never done that. First class is nice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't want to pay an extra.
I'm not going to pay $3,000 for a fucking plane ticket.
5% to 1,000% increase over what I'm paying to fly in steerage.
But it is nice.
I think I'm going to have the steak. How about you?
I'm not hungry.
Well, why don't you then get the lobster, because then I can get a little surf and turf action going.
And meanwhile, there's this slow build of Grodin sitting next to him, and it is beautiful.
No, I can't. No, no. No, I can't.
Just relax. Just relax.
Yeah.
What did I do?
Yeah.
Don't pull that shit on me.
No. I'm telling you. I can't do it. No.
Get over
there. I can't. These things go down.
All right.
These things go down. They go. It's too big. It can't go up.
It's my favorite scene in the movie. It really is. The slow progression of his, as we find out later in the film, fake being unsettled by being on the plane, the flight. It's just genius. It's absolute genius because he doesn't overdo it. It's so believable and so funny in the way everyone is reacting to it. And he's just, I can't. And he's almost holding on to De Niro like, you've got to help me. You don't understand. So it isn't like overly done.
No,
so the people watching
beautiful.
It are like, geez, this is really happening. You know, it's so brilliant.
These things go down.
Yeah.
These things go down. Oh, it's amazing. The captain comes down and he flashes his FBI, badge, and like, this guy's my prisoner. Says I'm Alonzo Mosley, of course. And the captain's like, you can't take a prisoner who doesn't want to fly on this plane.
I wonder if that's true.
I don't know.
I can't imagine they have a choice in the matter.
I would imagine it's true because you unsettle the passengers if you have someone who can't fly because they freak out.
Give them some volume.
Well, like, I guess. But isn't that violating his civil rights to sedate him?
I don't know. I saw.
I don't know.
I'm not saying
it didn't seem to be an issue on Con Air. I mean,
well, those are already convicted criminals. This guy is still,
I see. Yeah. So it's when he's still not fully through the legal.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Glad we figured that out.
Well, he's going to be a, I guess they have him on trial, but the FBI wants to flip him.
Right.
To use him to, you know, be a stoolie against the mob boss.
And this is the thing that, you know, the moral problems with what De Niro is doing is huge, which is that the FBI wants to flip him and make him in witness protection because this is the key to, part of the key of the movie is what the Duke did was a heroic thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And De Niro knows that he's bringing him back to at least put him in jail and that people want to kill him. And so what he's doing is very questionable in lots of ways. And we'll get more into that as we go into the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But right now we're going into Grand Central Station because we're going to take a train. which Grodin is like, I love riding the train.
Yeah, I know.
What are you smiling?
He's got that smirk. We get onto the train and the Duke is very happy to see, oh, we got a nice double room. This is really nice. And De Niro leads him back to the bathroom. Puts him in, handcuffs him to the inside the bathroom, and says,
"So this is my room, and that's your room. Good night."
I just the thereafter when he's pleading his case.
Yeah.
There's no air. There's no ventilation in here. I told you I was claustrophobic. Come on. What do you think I'm gonna do? Jump off a train moving 90 miles an hour? Jack.
That's what kills me about that. It just eventually, it's like, it's worth more to me to get him out here and shut him up as opposed to just keeping him in a separate little, you know, cubicle.
Well, this is the thing with what Grodin did with this character is it's this monotone, Jack.
Exactly.
You know, I'd be surprised if he, like, figured out that it was the Chinese water torture technique.
Totally. Because
it's eventually, it's just the water, and you're just like, I can't do it anymore. It just slowly wearing you down.
Well, it would pivot too. So it would be that, and then it turned to nice.
Yeah.
And then he turned back to that and be like, I'm sure this violates some sort of ACLU thing, Jack. Come on. What do we, you know?
Yeah.
It'll pivot back and just keep going. It's relentless and it'll just drive him nuts eventually.
Yeah.
It must be tough to be married to him. That is not a guy like you want a marital fight with. It seems really difficult.
Honey.
Don't you think you should be putting that over there?
Honey.
Yeah. Well, he's just passive aggressive nonstop. Yeah,
that seems to be his main.
I'm amazed he's still married.
Well, he does have some money. Millions of dollars. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we have at LAX, and there's Alonzo at the plane, and he's talking to the captain, and he says, "I'm Special Agent Mosley." And the captain's response is, "Are all you guys named Mosley?"
Mm-hmm. That means he took your badge.
Yeah.
And I love that turnaround of Yaphet going to look at this idiot like, yeah, you think? You dumb son of a bitch.
And they hear what happened. And at the same time, Jimmy Serrano is calling.
Yeah. Is this moron number one? Put moron number two on the phone.
Which is really how I think of those two guys. I had to look up that they're named Tony and Joey.
Yeah.
But to me, they're just moron number
Tweedledee
one.
Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Yeah. And I love, Farina has all of these great lines like,
you and that other dummy better start getting more personally involved in your work or I'm going to stab you through the heart with a fucking pencil. Do you understand me?
and then Joey, which is sort of the dumber of the two morons, goes, he ain't mad at me, is he, Tony?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's where the two of them, which you brought up before, being the underlings and whatnot, they inject humor into so many different spots that it helps move the movie along, too. It doesn't drag it down. It gets too serious or, you know, it gives it a nice even keel throughout.
Yeah.
Back in the sleeper car, Jack has now got a little notepad and he's doing something on it. And the Duke asks him, what are you doing? Arithmetic. What for?
Well, you know, I was thinking after I turn your ass in and collect my money, I'm going to open up a nice little coffee shop.
And I love the first thing he does. He goes, well, if you're taking $100,000 to take me back, will you take $200,000 to let me go?
I never took a payoff in my life, and I'm not going to start with someone like you.
And there's a long pause. And then the Duke goes, a restaurant is a very tricky business.
Yeah.
If I were your accountant, I'd have to strongly advise you against it.
You would, huh? Yeah. Well, you're not my accountant.
No, I mean, if I were your accountant.
I told you. I took you out here.
No, I'm just saying that it's a very, very tricky business. And if I were your accountant, I would really strongly have to advise you against it as an accountant.
You're not my accountant.
I realize I'm not your accountant.
And then again, he won't let it go. You're right. It's Chinese water torture. Yep. It's just keep poking at him. And what is, and the last thing that Jack does in the scene is play with his watch, which again is one of these running threads, which are all so good in this film. I wish we should add them up at some point, which is like, there's the sunglasses, there's the FBI badge, there's the playing with the watch,
there's the car door, and then the, hey, look over there.
Yep.
Yep.
There's a bunch. I think we're going to find more.
I mean, obviously the Grodin constant.
Yeah.
But that's not quite the same
thing. Well, and we're going to have repetitions of lines like, why were you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department?
Yeah.
You know, the repetition is really important in comedy. You know, I won't speak to you. You're the expert.
It's utterly subjective. So sometimes it works. You can play by the rules, and sometimes the rules fail you because maybe the joke sucks.
Well,
because
it has to actually be funny. That's the other part.
Yeah. And then that in and of itself is subjective. Because some people find things that funny, and you, all of us sit there and go, I don't know what you're fucking talking about. Like, that is terrible.
Eddie, however, is also upset that they missed the plane, and so his response is, we should bring in Marvin. And we cut to Marvin in a motel room, eating some stuff with a dude handcuffed in the bathroom. Apparently, handcuffing a guy in a bathroom, that's a standard move.
Was he in the bathroom? I thought he was lying on the bed, and the other chained next to the TV.
Yeah, he's not in the bathroom yet. He's chained next to the TV. He moves him into the bathroom later. He moves Duke into the bathroom. Yeah,
Duke
into
the bathroom later. But
oh, I thought he was chained. Uh-huh. No,
he's chained by the TV. Yeah,
that dude just stays there, and then just, hey, guess what, asshole? It's your lucky day.
Yeah. He leaves him there.
Because he gets the call from Eddie that he's going to give him a big payout, $25,000. To go get, and the other one of the just nice little detail is when he asked De Niro, do you know about Jonathan Mardukas? And he says, oh yeah, this is the accountant guy. When he asked Marvin, he goes, no, I have no fucking idea who that guy is.
That lets you know, the less educated you are, the less money you're going to make in life, no matter what.
Yeah.
That's a life lesson right there.
Mostly.
I hadn't brought those two together, but that is true.
Just saying.
As soon as Marvin decides to take the job, gets on the phone call, calls Jack's credit card company, apparently has his social security number.
Yeah, apparently.
And says, where was the last time I spent my money?
The Amtrak office, Grand Central Station? Huh. Oh, yeah, I remember that now. Yeah, okay, yeah, thanks very much. Maybe we ought to cancel that card, huh?
So Dorfler's an idiot, but
he's good at his job.
He is good at
his job. He knows what he's doing
in
specific moments.
We're in the dining car. Jack's got some delicious-looking fried chicken or something. The Duke is just staring at him.
Familiar with the word arteriosclerosis? You want to outline a complete balanced diet for you.
It was hard for me with this movie because I wrote down the whole scene.
Well, it's great scripts.
It's so funny.
Well, the back and forth, too, and then when he twists it back on him later. Oh, so you're doing something that you know is bad for you?
Which is the, you know, he's eating stuff that he knows is bad for you, and we get to this, you know, you're living in denial. Oh, I'm aware of it. And that he stole money from the mob, which he knew was a bad idea. And he's like, I'm aware of it.
Yeah.
And we get to this one other thing, which is that, did you just do this because you want people to love you because you gave all the money to charity?
Don't you want to be loved?
Lots of people love me.
Really? Who?
I got an ex-wife and I got a daughter in Chicago.
How do they put up with all your sarcasm?
Beautifully. I haven't seen either of them in 9 years.
And again, we get to this, okay, what's the deal here? What's the backstory?
I think that's why Grodin likes him from the beginning, because he senses Jack is not an idiot. Jack is not a standard bounty hunter or whatever. There's something more to him. And the fact that Jack surrenders this information in this moment, like, why does he tell him about the kid and the wife? Like, it's weird, but they're developing a sort of, like, it's a slow friendship that's building through the movie, and that those windows are happening. And I think Jack, well, and you know, like I said, this is my analysis of the situation. The fact that finally Jack has like turned the tables on Charles Grodin in that scene and said, oh, you do things that are bad for you as well. It makes him feel a little comfortable. And then he can reveal that information a little bit more because he's revealing it from a position of power rather than duress. And so it's interesting.
Well, it also seems to be part of Grodin's technique.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is like, I'm going to poke at you and poke at you and poke at you. And then eventually Jack's going to let something slip just to shut him up. And then now he's got an opening.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's going to try to wedge himself into that opening because now he's asking about the why. Why don't you visit them?
Yeah.
You know, like,
find commonality, humanize the situation.
Yeah.
And it's all in the sort of the guise of I'm being nice to you and offering you some advice. But it's also just that poking is going on. And at which point he shuts it down. It's like, dinner's over. You know, you don't have any right to ask me these questions. And then we have this one other thing. As they're leaving, he says, in addition to him criticizing how much he tips the waiters, as they're leaving, he says,
well, I wouldn't worry about it, Jack. I'm not going to be with you that much longer.
What do you mean?
Well, what I know about Serrano, if I go to jail, I'll be dead within 24 hours. So sooner or later, I'm going to have to give you the slip.
And then Marvin Dorfler boards the train.
Can I help you, sir?
Yeah. I'm looking for this buddy of mine, Jack Walsh. He told me he'd meet me on this train.
Mr. Walsh. She's in bedroom D, next car.
Goes in, sees Jack asleep, finds Charles Grodin in the bathroom, and then, boom, gets slammed up against the wall by Jack. Gun taken away, thrown on the floor. Porter runs up. What's going on? He says,
all right, everything's under control. Take it easy. Alonzo Mosley, FBI. Radio ahead. I want the local police at the next stop to place this man under arrest.
The fuck are you talking
about? That's enough out of you!
Bye, Marvin. I guess we're never going to see him again. And now we're back to FBI agent Alonzo, who finds out that Mardukas and Walsh were on an Amtrak, and another bounty hunter was arrested, and Alonzo goes,
I want the jet ready in 20 minutes.
Now we're at the next train stop, and Alonzo Mosley has got a whole bunch of guys with a whole bunch of guns. Search the train, probably got out two or three stops. And the porter comes up to him and says,
his real name's Mosley.
I'm Mosley!
Yeah, just more good character development from him throughout. You're only going to give him small scenes, at least they're memorable.
And now Jack calls up Eddie again. Again, Jerry answers. Again, Jerry listens in on the call. And now Jack is pissed about why did you put Dorfler on this case? Mm-hmm. And by the way, one of the smart things they did, normally when you do phone calls on a movie set, you're not going to bring in an actor who's not shooting that day. And so usually, like, the script supervisor will read the other part with the actor. De Niro was on every single phone call with Joey Pants.
Wow.
They always were acting with each other when they did this stuff.
That's great.
And it shows because they're really tight and they're improvising together.
Yeah.
I love the him banging the phone on the when he's talking.
Are you done, Jack? Are you done?
Yeah. And now he says, okay, we're going to get on a bus. And of course, the guys in the van are watching, and Jerry says, I'm going to go get some donuts. And so we're continuing with this same thing. So let's buy a one-way ticket to LA at the bus stop. Credit card's been denied. Jack's like, no, I paid the bill, run it again. There are a lot of movies that have the run it again.
Yeah.
Including a movie that was released 1 year earlier that I kept thinking about on this film. Hmm. Another film that started off in an airplane and then went to a train and then went to an automobile and buses. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. There's a lot of similarities with this movie.
And the score is similar as well.
Yep.
Those brow, brow moments that are there, yeah.
And you have these two characters from different backgrounds who are eventually going to kind of work together on some level. And they're going to, you know, they're going to lose everything as they fight their way across. I mean, it was really weird.
Interesting.
I mean, they're not the same, but it's like they're 1 year apart.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of similarities. And
those pictures were doing well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the same thing, but different.
And what makes the scene as he's talking about the credit card getting declined is Charles Grodin's reaction shots, just shaking his head. Oh, yeah, he's not responsible. And all the eye contact with the woman who's behind the desk. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the parent kind of standing there like, look at him. He's trying, but this is sad.
And finally, he takes the last thing, which is, of course, his credit card says Jack Walsh. He pulls out his FBI badge.
Alonzo, Jack Walsh. Federal Bureau of Investigation. This is an official business. I'm taking this man and he's in my custody. I'm taking him to Los Angeles, okay? So please try this once more.
Jack Walsh is not the name on that badge, sir. Would you like me to call the FBI? Or would you like to pay cash?
I'll pay cash. And he doesn't have enough, so he asks, John, do you got any cash? And he goes, oh, I got lots of money. And he reaches into his pocket and pulls out like $20. You call that lots of money? Buys his tickets and they're on the bus. Mm-hmm. Marvin is sitting with some cops and in walks Agent Mosley. And every time he shows up, there's that theme. Walks in, takes his pack of cigarettes, lights a cigarette, pockets the pack.
Yeah, straight up too.
Yep. Like
that was a full on. I used to smoke and I couldn't imagine sitting there watching. Hey, what are you doing with that? Just like lighter is one thing. That happens all the time. People snake lighters, but just to take the cigarettes.
Take the whole pack.
Not even flinch. Just puts it right in his pocket like he does this to all the people he works with.
And this is another running gag. And he asks what he knows about Walsh. And now we're back on the bus. Jack is smoking on the bus. That was one of the weird things watching the movie. Yeah. We're smoking on the plane.
Right.
We're smoking, on the bus.
Everywhere.
We're smoking everywhere.
Yeah. Waiting in line to buy tickets.
Yep.
Smoking.
We're just smoking cigarettes.
Forget.
Yeah.
I know. I remember when the band was coming and I thought it was crazy. I didn't even smoke at that point. I'd given it up and I was like, you smoke at a bar.
Yeah.
And now I can't imagine going to like a theater or friggin' Arby's. They used to have little ashtrays.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just ridiculous.
Well, and your car had an ashtray. Right.
Yeah.
And it was funny, like when I go to places of like be in Vegas or something where they do allow smoking, I'm like, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It stinks.
You smell like it the next day.
Yep.
It's like it's all there. But I don't know. It ages you.
And the Duke has some problems with the smoking. Why are you doing this? Cigarettes are killers.
Put it out.
Again, he's poking at him.
Put it out. Jack.
Yeah, put it out.
Put it out.
And I love there's a moment where it looks like he's putting it out. He doesn't put it out. I thought you were putting it out. No.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
And then if it's not poking about the cigarettes, he goes, you know, when we change buses in Chicago, why don't you look up your wife and your dog? It'll be good for you.
Why don't you mind your own business?
And again, he gets poked and he poked and he reveals a little bit more.
Why?
Yeah.
Just to get you off my back, I'll tell you why. She married a police lieutenant and I'm not very popular with the Chicago Police Department, okay?
Why aren't you popular with Chicago Police Department?
That's a whole other... What, do we know each other? Why?
And he's going to ask that question over and over.
Why aren't you popular with Chicago Police Department?
Well, something that really doesn't concern you.
She hurt you, Janet?
Yeah.
And I love this.
I'm sorry.
What are you sorry about?
I'm sorry you're hurt.
I'm not hurt.
You just said you were hurt.
I'm not hurt.
You just said you were hurt.
I didn't say I was hurt. You said I was hurt.
I asked you if you were hurt, and you said, yeah, I'm hurt.
That's because you made me say. You're starting to put words in my mouth.
Jack, you're a grown man. You have control over your own words.
You're goddamn right I do. So here come two words for you. Shut the fuck up.
That's a perfectly constructed joke. And then, of course, because Yaphet Kotto is always one step behind, he finds out that Walsh is on the bus. They say we're going to let Marvin go. And if we're still on the bus, and now he's talking about chest x-rays and secondhand smoke. And again, he asks, why aren't you popular with the Chicago Police Department? We're back in Vegas with Jimmy Serrano, and he gets visited by Sidney.
Philip Baker Hall.
Who's great and obviously has some concern about what's going on with the Duke.
He's the mob lawyer.
But Serrano's like, everything's taken care of. We're all good. Because the bus is pulling into the station, and a whole bunch of snipers are setting up to take it out. And the FBI pulls up. Just as people are starting to come out of the bus, and out come Jack and the Duke, and Alonzo goes, remember me? And he puts on those sunglasses. He's, hey, oh, Agent Foster Grant. Do they still have Foster Grant glasses?
I don't think so.
I don't think that's a brand.
No, I think that died a long time ago.
So, and then those snipers, man, they open fire.
Yeah, it was weird. That was a weird thing, right?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense when you watch it. You're like, at that point, all of you can turn, like, walk away, and no one's going to be upset with you. Why do you
there's
fire?
Like 50 cops here.
Yeah, why is this a suicide mission?
Well, and they're shitty snipers.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like...
Oh, yeah.
They hit no one.
Especially when the FBI just opens up, and they have revolvers, and, like, three of those dudes die.
Yeah. But it does create enough of a distraction for Jack and the Duke to run away, goes over a wall, starts dragging him away... And Jack jumps into Alonzo's actual car, puts on the siren, and they drive away. Yep. And in the car, you know, first of all, there's the Duke realizes that those are Serrano's people, and they're trying to kill him. And then he sees some paperwork, and he sees that, wait, Alonzo has a bug on Eddie's phone, and that's how the FBI has been figuring out where they're going. Leaves the glasses on the steering wheel. Again, we get the sunglasses joke. And... Now one our morons get to call Jimmy and tell him that it didn't happen. And this is the scene you were talking about with the shadow boxing that is just so great.
Yeah, because they're like, oh, it all went to hell. The one guy is like, everything went nuts. And the other guy is literally just, it's such good comedy. And guy hardly says a word.
Yep. And now we're back to Jack's wife's house.
I can't believe this. I haven't seen either of them in 9 years. The first thing out of my mouth is going to be, can I borrow a few $100?
I have a feeling this is going to be very good for you.
Person that answers the first is a kid.
Who are you guys?
I'm your mother's ex-husband.
And, of course, now we find out that they're on the news. She knows about him. He's in big trouble. And he comes inside and he says, I want to borrow some money. And the kid is looking at Charles Grodin and goes, you don't look much like a criminal. I'm a white-collar criminal.
Yeah. It's a great little aside line.
It's great.
The actress here does a really nice job.
She's great.
It's literally one scene.
Yeah. And her and the little girl that's about to come. Yeah. She's excellent.
The girl's
too.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, because and it's like Ted, who's the lieutenant, is gonna come home, was now a captain. Mm-hmm. And now we hear more. It's like, oh well, I'm sorry, I don't have enough money to bribe him right now. Right. We get a sense of, which really makes me wonder about what is this story?
Yeah.
Like, she left Jack to marry a guy that was on the take, and did she know, and what did, and how did all this happen?
Yeah,
maybe. They took it for Jack had to split town,
yeah,
and she had to stay for whatever reason,
right,
and was forced to live there and raise their daughter, and this guy was making good money, he was on the fast track, he was going up, it provides security, everybody else is on the take, and we all know it, so why don't you, it is Chicago, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah, and the balance is great, which is that she doesn't want to be lectured by him, but she is sympathetic with him, and he does want to be nice to her, but he is also angry at her, and they're both kind of trying to make it through this, and then, of course, in wants the daughter, and the scene with the daughter is great.
So good.
This is where you see, I mean, I don't know if you're aware of the fact that De Niro is a really good actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's good.
This is what cemented it for you? This is when you finally went, this guy's got something.
I think he's got some talent here.
You know, I saw him in some other things earlier, but this is his next level right here.
They have a really nice scene.
Hi.
Denise? You got so big.
And I can't, I mean, I just think about, like, you left your kid? You haven't seen your kid for 9 years?
Well, this is what's interesting about acting, too. Like, this scene, that little girl is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
She did maybe one or two movies after, and then never again.
I couldn't place her. What were the other two movies, you know?
No, not at all. I was looking it up when I was watching the movie, and she was heralded out of Broadway. She'd won a drama. She'd been a nominated for Drama Desk Awards at 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The wife who plays the wife, she's been working steadily ever since. It gets two or three episodes every year on shows. So I was watching, I was like looking these people's IMDb up, because I'm always amazed that people will come in and do a solid, great work in these small little scenes with not a lot of time on screen, that yet they help to humanize the care of the main character so well, yet they don't go on to do these things over and over and over again. And I always wonder about their stories. And so it's my own thing.
That ending between the two of them when they're outside the car.
With the
and
really
she
nice.
Brings him,
sitting money?
Yeah, she brings him the money. And now knowing, having seen the full arc of the movie and to see his refusal of it, you can see the pain within him. And she doesn't understand why I had to leave. I was forced out. It was for your own safety.
Yeah.
And you're too young to understand that. I can't take your money. Like, God, I love you for the fact that you're so giving right now, because your only worldview is I left and I'm a shitty person.
Right.
And you're not wrong. You just don't know the full scope of the situation here. And they carry that out like, because I missed that the first time because you don't understand the subtext until the reveal later on. Right. So watching it a second time, you're like, man, that's some fucking great acting right there.
It really is.
Yeah.
Isn't much. About $180 babysitting money.
Oh, sweetheart, I can't. I can't.
Please.
I can't, sweetheart.
And by the way, the wife has given him $40 and the keys to the station wagon. Now we're at a payphone, and he makes a collect call for Eddie. Again, Jared gives Eddie the phone. And I love this scene. Where are you?
Where am I? I'm in Boise, Idaho. No, wait a minute. I'm in Anchorage, Alaska.
No, wait. I'm in Casper, Wyoming. I'm in the lobby of a Howard Johnson's, and I'm wearing a pink carnation.
And Eddie's like, what are you talking about? He goes, no, I'm talking to those other guys. Let me describe them. There are a couple of guys in a van, and they're constipated, and they smell of coffee, and they got lots of BO, and they've been sitting in the same place. And that's, of course, when he reveals that your phone is tapped. So then he gives him, go to Chen Lu's. They can't run a tap that fast. He runs over to Grand Central Market. Jack calls him. He says, wire $500 to the Western Union in Amarillo, Texas, and they're driving now. Of course, then who does Eddie tell to wire the money? But he tells Jerry, who we know is selling him out to the mob.
Right.
So we know the Amarillo news is going to go around real quick. And, of course, we tell Dorfler to let's get Marvin Dorfler down there, too. We're on the road.
96 bottles of beer on the wall. 96 bottles of beer on the wall. Ba ba boom. Ba da 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 boom. Not 93 bottles of beer on the wall.
Have you ever sung 99 bottles of beer on the wall on a road trip?
No.
Yeah.
Really?
In Catholic, the CYO stuff, you'd take those trips, you would do that in the buses. It was the worst.
I love it. What? Catholics, they still have a drinking song. I'm Catholic. So, makes a lot of sense, you know?
You know.
Weird. There's a lot of impermissible things in Catholicism, but drunkenness, that's not really one of them.
What number did you get to?
Well, I remember going over what? Starting over again.
Oh my God.
Yeah, these trips would last quite some time.
We sang it on like Boy Scout trips.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
But we only got to like 85.
Oh, Jesus. Like, where were you going?
Because the novelty wears off.
Because the song is boring and stupid.
Oh, well, sure. Oh, I see what you're saying. You mean where you'd stop?
We'd stop.
Oh, no, they wouldn't let us stop.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. After we finished, we got down to none left.
Yeah.
If they went, hey, 99,
yes,
literally.
That's exactly what happened.
Searching for a gun that doesn't exist. Oh, my God.
Just jump out that. You're looking at that emergency window thing on the bus. It's like, I can't do this again.
Yeah, you're going to have like repetitive stress syndrome from just banging your head against the glass.
But Charles Grodin's interpretation of this song is 93 bottles of beer on
jumps
the
ahead.
Wall. Yeah, he skips a bunch of numbers.
He's like, yeah, he's just humming it along, and then suddenly they're three ahead. Oh, the hum was worth three, wasn't it?
And we go, of course, right into it.
Why were you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department? Because your personality?
And then he gives him a little more that his wife married a corrupt cop. And he asks, what happened to you? And again, great reaction from De Niro. He has just, it's the comedy chops that I'd never seen before that are just so good.
But also, it also feels like this case and this guy showed up at a time when he was having his own thoughts about what he's doing with his life. Mm-hmm. Like, he seems to have caught him at this time when he's self-reflective about his life.
Right.
Which is why when he's asking these questions, De Niro is kind of playing that in wanting to tell him and wanting to be open about it, but then like not being sure about it, but it's definitely something that's been weighing on his mind.
Well, plus what other social interaction does he have?
Yeah.
Who does he have to talk to?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
He's such a solitary individual. If you're a bounty hunter and you're dealing with loan sharks, that guy's the closest thing you have to a friend.
Right.
You can't tell him all this stuff and you're alone and Grodin's not so bad.
Well, yeah, because most of the guys he's bringing in are just low-life scumbags.
Yeah.
He's not going to share anything with them.
Tried to shoot him with a shotgun and that's, we assume, par for the course.
Yeah, but now he's got many days with this guy who is intelligent and perceptive and keeps asking.
Compassionate. You know? You already know that because he gave the money away to the poor.
Right, yeah.
Like, moralistically a good person.
Yeah. And now we do hear a little bit more that he was an undercover cop, that he was working a heroin dealer. He had spent a year getting close to the guy.
Right.
And then he got framed. You know, they planted a bunch of heroin in on him, and his choices were go on the payroll or go to jail. And he says, I didn't go on the payroll. And you think he just skipped town. That's
what I assumed.
I'm never sure. I think you're right. I think that seems like a good explanation for what happened.
Because there's never any, I spent time in prison. He doesn't seem fully disgraced because the cops are still interacting with him.
Yeah.
Whereas if he had done time, I think it'd be bounty hunter and going into a police station would be kind of difficult just from the...
Yeah,
they're already
right.
Breaking his balls in that first one. He's like, I think, was it the snack machine was broken the
other
day?
Right, kind of thing.
So if he had been in jail, they don't even make that joke with him. It's just, you know, fuck you.
I think you're right. And the next thing, of course, he does is check his watch.
Did you get yourself a new watch?
Tell you when I know you better.
And I love Grodin's response, which is sort of...
You know me better. When are you going to get to know me better? I'm going to get to know you better. You're not going to get to know me better.
Shut up. That's what I mean.
Because, De Niro doesn't ask him any questions.
Right.
We're into a diner. It's breakfast. Grodin asks, how much money we have left? De Niro puts the money on the table. And we look at it, it's not a lot of coins.
No.
This is great.
But he did use the money to buy cigarettes, which he's smoking inside. And the waitress comes up.
How much is the coffee?
It's 53 cents.
How much is tea?
53 cents.
And then there's this amazing pause. And he looks down at the money. And he looks up at her and says,
love tea.
I think this is the funniest moment in the movie for me.
Oh, really? Oh man, it's a good moment.
Love, because what is he thinking about there?
Right.
They both cost the same. He's looking, what is he calculating?
If you watch that scene, I think he's improvising because you catch the actress look to her left past De Niro.
Oh, really?
Which is looking at the director going, do I keep going? Like, and he's probably going, you know, like this and playing along with it. You can catch, it's a quick glance, but she does goes, And then does it.
Yeah,
it's
so
great.
I have to go back and rewatch for that.
It's so great.
It sounds like, by the way, with Grodin and De Niro, it's not that there was a lot of improv,
right?
But there was a lot of, they were in the hotel room running lines with Brest and Gallo and ad-libbing there and then incorporating that. And the script was being rewritten just constantly as they're going.
Right.
So they're not just making it up on the set, but a lot of this is coming from their, you know, playing. And I love, too, that, you know, she tells about the special, which is chorizo and eggs. And there's just a long description about what that exactly means.
Chorizo? It's a Mexican sausage. Oh, it's all brilliant.
But we find out that in 9 or 10 minutes, we're going to go over to Western Union. You can have anything you want. What does he want? Chorizo and eggs. And I love, this is the first time that I think he calls him John.
You know, John, you're in this mess because you're in this mess. I didn't put you in this mess. You understand?
Yeah.
If you had left Jimmy Serrano alone, this wouldn't be happening.
And this is the first time we hear that actually he had more of a plan. He had a way out, which is that he was going to copy all of the information on all the transactions, whatever, onto some disks, which, of course, at the time were floppy disks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he would have leverage over Serrano because he could wipe him out and all of the bad guys. But he got arrested before he had time to do that.
Yep.
And that's a key, you know, piece of exposition that gets thrown out. And Jack's response is, why didn't you just leave him alone? And he goes, why didn't you leave the heroin dealer alone?
Yeah.
And now we hear a little bit more of Groton's backstory, which is he thought he had a legitimate job.
Yeah.
And the discovery of going like, oh, I'm actually helping horrible criminals do horrible things was hugely painful.
Yeah, but John, you still took what didn't belong to you.
How can you be on the side of a mobster?
I'm not on the side of a mobster.
You're on his side if you're not on my side.
I'm not on anybody's side. I got nothing to do with it.
You got everything to do with this. You're taking me to jail, and in jail, you know I'll be killed.
And this is where the real moral issues with Jack Walsh happen. Mm. And I love Groden's argument, which is...
Did you read about me in the papers?
Yeah, I did.
Were you on my side then?
Yeah, I was.
Then why aren't you now?
Because now you're in my way.
I'm in your way.
I'm in your way.
What you mean is you want the money for turning me in, because that's all you're about. You're just about the fucking money.
Yeah, but it's also like Jack has a certain code.
Right.
And right now you are unfortunately violating the one that supersedes apparently most others, which is my bread and butter. And that 100,000 could change his entire, you know, life. And you are his, not meal ticket, so to speak, but... You're a criminal.
Yeah.
You don't have a high ground to stand on.
Well, that's, I think he's divided up the world into criminals and not criminals. Mm-hmm. And this guy's on the criminal side, except that he's a good guy, you know? And I think that's starting to penetrate a little bit. And it's interesting, too, because he was around all the cops, and those cops were on the criminal side, really, you know? And yet they were not criminals. They were cops. Like, this is where I think Jack is getting forced to think about these things. And we don't know at this point in the movie how much he's really thinking about them, like what he really thinks. Joey and Tony, our two morons, are at a helicopter trying on a hat, maybe take a picture. And of course, who do they see before they even have to get in the helicopter? But Jack and the Duke walking out of that diner and they grab him. And Jimmy sends his regards. And this is the end. I think these guys are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Except who comes up? But Marvin firing a shotgun.
Dorfler.
Yeah.
I love the way this is constructed, that we keep having our characters interact at just the perfect times. And does Marvin know who these guys are?
Yeah. No clue.
Knocks out one guy with the butt of the shotgun. Oof. Which,
what does he say it into the mic? And then just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bam. And then there's just some, who the fuck are you? Who the fuck are you? And he knocks Tony out. And as this is going on, Jack handcuffs himself to John, and Marvin's like, give me the keys, and he takes out his keys, and he drops them in the sewer.
Yep. Package deal.
Yep. Got to take them together. And we're driving along, and now Marvin's asking the question. I love, by the way, that we sit all three in the front seat.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really make sense, but it's great for the shot.
Well, if you put them in the back seat, though, now they're a threat to the driver.
Oh, actually, you're right.
So that's, you have to put him in the front seat.
That's actually a really good point. And Marvin's now, the first time he's finding out that these are hired killers. Hired to kill who? And who sent them? And then we hear the name Jimmy Serrano. And even Marvin's heard of Jimmy Serrano.
Yeah, if you got that much juice.
Yeah.
Regular civilians have heard of Jimmy Serrano at that point.
And while they're arguing, what should show up? But there's that helicopter. And they're opening fire at them. And there's a great, great reaction, particularly from Groden with,
you guys are the dumbest bounty hunters I've ever seen.
I love that he's kind of smiling through this whole thing.
Uh-huh.
What does he say? You couldn't protect a...
He says you couldn't deliver a bottle of milk.
He couldn't deliver a bottle of milk. Oh, my God.
And they're just screaming at each other.
God, I paused the movie. I was laughing so hard when he said that.
And then, of course, they think, oh, we lost the helicopter.
Yeah. It was that easy. They just slipped them.
To which Groden's response is,
oh, I'm sure we're completely safe.
And there's the copter. Then we go off road, get out of the car, and they ask the Duke, are you all right? Oh, yeah, I'm really enjoying it. He's great. Mm. He's like, someone compared him to sort of the Jack Benny sort of slow burn, okay. You know, that underplayed. And really, Charles Grodin's just a unique, totally unique kind of voice, I think. And it makes me sad that there weren't more things. Like, this and Dave are the two movies.
Probably by his choice.
Maybe. He did a lot of theater. I know that.
Like, him and Brooks. You're right to say Brooks earlier, Albert Brooks.
I am right there, but you said.
Excuse me, gentlemen. It was me.
Oh, sorry.
You
said it.
Attributing him, and he's attributing you, and I'm over here going, I'm the one that brought up the brilliant point here, guys. You know what?
We know how to
7.5%.
Sorry. We're dummy one and dummy two.
We know how to disrespect a guest.
That's right.
Exactly. You guys built me up, and now you're just stealing my good points from earlier.
That's how we do it.
That's how you do it with stand-up comedy.
You were right, sir, to say Albert Brooks.
Uh-huh. That's fine.
He's very much from the Brooks school. Because that underplay, everything's underplayed.
It's also a specific type of humor.
Yeah.
That doesn't, I mean, it could translate, but it's harder to just pure dry.
And you have to have the right person to do it.
You do, and the right role. Yep. I mean, look at Chevy Chase. It is nothing but dry, and in the wrong role, it's the worst. It is the worst.
Even in Taxi Driver, Brooks has those moments. In Taxi Driver, he has those moments.
Thank God, because otherwise that movie gets rough.
Yeah.
Jack's asking for a gun, and there's some resistance there. Eventually, Marvin gives him a gun, and what does Jack do next? Uncuffs himself.
Yeah.
Because he threw away car keys.
Yeah.
Always
check the evidence.
Evidence, that's what it was.
Yeah. And now they're opening fire on the helicopter, and Groden goes into the river. And after he goes into the river, Marvin finds out they're talking about the money that Eddie offered him. And that's when he finds out that Jack was going to get $100,000.
Yeah, and a contract.
And a contract.
Yeah.
And then we have what I can only describe as the Danny Glover Lethal Weapon moment as he takes careful aim at the chopper. Almost
quasi believable. If you hit that back rotor, like, and he unloads, five shots, six shots into it. So they're not saying it's pure, you know, Schwarzenegger and Last Action Hero, where you can just, you know, they're making fun of that. Yeah. But in the movie, you just take one shot, it hits the gas can or the gas tank, it explodes. Like, he rifles off five, six shots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're ramping up the level of silliness because we're about to get to a car chase that is just ridiculous.
Yeah. But this is at least plausibly real.
Sure.
It's not going cartoonish.
I'm not disliking it. I'm merely saying it's a moment.
Yeah.
He shoots it. So the chopper goes down, and then he does the same little trick on Marvin, punches him out, cuffs Marvin to the car, tosses the keys away, says, see you in LA, and jumps into the river. Right. The old jump into the river move. So originally when they shot this, they did this at the Colorado River, because that made sense, in the middle of winter. And they had... De Niro had two wetsuits on, was in there for 3 minutes and sank underwater, like could barely move.
Wow.
And they went, oh, no, we can't do this. So they flew to New Zealand.
What?
Where it is not cold.
Huh.
And that's where they shot it.
New Zealand?
Yeah.
Wow, before, like, New Zealand was somewhere you go to film.
Pre-Hobbit. Jesus. Yeah. Isn't that crazy? And so they're both going down the rapids, and finally Groden gets out. De Niro's hanging onto a rock, and... offers him a big log to grab and says,
promise to let me go? You promise to let me go? Fuck you! Promise to let me go?
Fuck you!
You're making it very difficult for me to do the right thing here!
And De Niro promises, gets him out of the river, and they're talking for a minute, and he's saying thanks, and what does De Niro do? Cuffs him.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I'll let you go to the second you're in the L.A. County Jail. Next thing that happened, cops find Marvin. And I love we come back to Groden and De Niro. He's just on some monologue about Leonese potatoes.
Yeah, out of nowhere. With all the money, he's like, it goes great with steak and pork chops. And I not only has anybody, have you guys had Leonese potatoes?
Yeah,
I don't know
what
it is.
I have, yes. They're delicious. It's like fried potatoes and onions.
Ooh.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
how are they? Are they scalloped? Are they like
more like... more like sort of roasted, like roasted cute potato. Kind of a fancy version of your breakfast.
Breakfast
home fries. Yeah.
Oh. Sure.
Yeah. But very tasty.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in favor of all the potato foods. There's no, you know, way you could do a potato that I'm against.
Fries, mash,
fries, mash, scalloped, hash browns.
Be at least one way the potato sucks.
Potato au gratin, I'm not a big fan of.
Yeah. Really? Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Potato soup.
Yeah, it's not my favorite, but I could do it. Potato soup, sure. But
potato soup I can do.
Yeah, I got to be in the mood for it. This got to be like just a straight boiled potato, but that can be good in a pot roast
or
something.
Salt.
Yeah.
Salt and butter. Roasted. Yeah, I like potatoes.
Boom.
Here we go, guys. Cinephiles is pro potatoes.
Very controversial stance.
Have you guys thought about that for a t-shirt? It's a merchandising sales year.
Potatoes.
I think we can finally make it with this potato thing. We flag down a truck with some Native Americans and hop in the back. The morons have arrived in Vegas. Jimmy is pissed. You know, again, and this is sort of just touching in with our bad guys. The truck stops at this place in the middle of nowhere. You ever been to a place like this?
Are you asking that as a legitimate question?
Yes. Please?
Okay. Because I couldn't remember if I was thinking, did De Niro ever turn to Grodin and say that? That remote, maybe. I've done a lot of cross country driving.
Yeah, I was at one place. Where I was like, oh wow, it's interesting.
Without phone is kind of difficult.
Yeah, I don't know if I've been without.
Wait, what was the question?
Have you ever been in a really middle of the nowhere?
Yes, we broke down in Arizona when my dad and I were driving me cross country to move to LA. We broke down in Arizona with no cell service.
Where in Arizona?
In the middle of the Red Clay Mountains.
Oh, yeah.
On the one-lane highways. And in my mind, because we had rented a diesel, because those idiots fucking rented us a diesel from U-Haul.
And you can't get gas everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
We had to gas up every, like, 50 miles. It was insane.
But.
And so.
Still, though, as for a U-Haul, diesel is much better, you know?
I guess.
You get more bang for your buck. It's got better low-end torque. I mean, I'm saying if you're moving, diesel makes a lot of sense.
Not across country.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about the logistics of that, but it would make sense. Usually diesel gets better mileage.
That's what I'm saying. So we stopped in the, because it kept breaking down because of an overheat.
Right. Oh, geez.
So it kept breaking down, overheat. So in Arizona, when it broke down in the middle, like, seriously, nothing but Red Clay Mountains.
What route were you going through?
Because
that sounds like what, Sedona area?
Probably 90. We took the 95 and then hooked on from something.
You were on the 10 for most of it, probably.
Yeah, because
the 10 you have to clip from
Phoenix.
The bottom.
Right.
Right. So we were clipping.
I don't know where the Red Clay Mountains are.
Yeah.
Well, either way, it was just like cliffs and red clay. It was just all around.
And you're just nowhere.
One lane highways.
Yeah.
Right. Middle of nowhere. Hot as fuck. No cell service.
Because this is where, like, you can die.
Well, this is what I was thinking. I was like, well, if no cars come, and no cars came for like forever, if no cars come, we'll have to hide inside the U-Haul, and Dad and I have to figure out how to sleep.
Yeah.
And we had my car on my old Mitsubishi Eclipse on one of those things. Mm. So one of us would sleep, obviously, in the car, and the other one would sleep
no
in the
gas
car.
In the car?
No. So it was like that kind of thing where I was like, okay, what are we going to do here?
Dude, you have an escape pod and you don't fuel it? Come
I didn't
on.
Know what to tell you, buddy. We didn't think we were going to break down.
Next time you have gas in that car.
Yeah, right. Next time I have gas everywhere.
Is that convertible Eclipse? Because that would have been gorgeous in the night sky in the desert.
All I was thinking about is coyotes and wolves. That's all I was thinking about is like pure fear.
Well, so, you're not a nature guy.
No, I really fucking hate nature. Like, I respect it. I respect it.
You should.
I don't want anything to do with it.
I think I'd be more afraid of snakes and scorpions.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good point. We didn't get that far. So eventually, the truck did work at like maybe 2 hours after we broke down the
car. Oh, just to cool down.
And we got out of it. Yeah. It was lucky.
So we're in this middle of nowhere place. There's not even a phone. The nearest phone is 30 miles away.
Yeah.
The Duke sees this old biplane, which I don't know quite what it's doing there. Maybe it's an old crop duster or something.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah. Kind of out of nowhere. Like, why did these guys?
Yeah.
But it's okay.
It adds to the life of the movie itself. It gives it a nice little.
But we're not going to spend a lot of time.
No, it's just like out of nowhere. It's like, what? There's a plane?
A plane that's apparently fueled up and ready to go.
Yeah, keys are in it.
Yeah, because Grodin goes like, can I go use the bathroom? And as De Niro's talking about where to get a phone, get a ride, get a car, get something, he starts to hear this plane shot up, and there's the Duke piloting the plane.
They're a fly, you son of a bitch! Get over here! Get back here, son of a bitch!
He runs after him, grabs onto that plane, mm-hmm. And then this is where, like, the collateral damage of this thing you're doing is a lot. Yeah. Which, first of all, he starts taking off, and there's some, you know, fun stunt work. And then he slams down something. The plane goes down on the ground. He drags Grodin out of the plane, and the plane goes off and crashes.
His anger at Grodin is just
business. Oh, yeah. Well, and then it is the start of the "you lied to me."
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, you lied to me first kind of thing, back and forth.
Well, because this is, to be really clear, he lied about being afraid of getting on the plane, and now it ends up that he's a pilot.
He withheld certain information he didn't feel was pertinent.
Right. Jack pulls a gun and steals the truck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And offers the Duke's probably very expensive watch in trade, but, you know, stealing my thing and giving me something expensive in trade is actually still stealing my thing.
Well, especially in that remote, there's no phone.
There's no phone. There's like, no, I kind of need that truck. And now we do get into this. You lied to me first. No, you lied to me first.
Jack, let's be fair about this. You lied to me first. At the river.
What?
At the river.
Get the river. You lied to me first. You got some fucking nerve.
No, you lied to me first.
You lied to me first. Yes, yes, I lied to you first, but you had no knowledge I was lying about my fear of flying at the river when you lied to me. So as far as you knew, you lied to me first.
And I'm totally glad, because I never thought of that, but of course, you're right.
Yeah.
Jack Walsh lied to
him
first.
He lies first, yeah.
He said he was Alonzo Mosley for the FBI. That is the first lie.
True.
And we get this great moment. You know, he's starting to talk about his ulcer.
You know why you have an ulcer? Because you have two forms of expression. Silence. And rage.
De Niro's reaction in this moment is so brilliant, because what you see is the silence and rage
simultaneously
and going through all this whole thought process and then choosing to say nothing. It is perfect.
Yep. And given the way that we saw him have a dust up with his wife earlier, that seems like a fight that he's had before. Yep. And it's just like, oh, like his instant reaction is to blow his kettle.
That's who this guy is.
Yep.
And they got no money. He needs to get some food. And the Duke goes, you get me to the next town and I'll get us the money. I'll take care of it. And we're outside some corner bar. He asked for the FBI badge. He asked to get uncuffed. And there's this moment of like, you want to eat? And she's like, all right, whatever.
You fuck with me. And you'll hit me on the head and drop me in a thing.
But it diffuses the situation entirely. Like, I get it.
Yeah, De Niro's smirking. He's almost excited to see what this guy's going to do in this moment.
They walk inside. Who's in charge here? He's perfect. He does this so well.
This is the funniest scene, guys. I don't know what you guys, you're lying to yourselves.
It's great.
This is the funniest scene when he walks in and he's got, I love it. He's walking and he's slowly surveying and he stops, and De Niro's a bad actor because he doesn't act. You know, he's a bounty hunter.
Right.
And he bumps into him. He's like, oh shit, sorry. Kind of thing. And he's just looking around and gives him a little look, and he goes right back into character. Fucking the litmus configuration.
Yeah.
And De Niro's like, oh, I'm trying to. Yeah. He screws it up. Then he's like licking his thumb. This is a bad one. I love that this is the bad one.
Because what we're doing, for those of you who have not watched it, is Duke is pretending to be Alonzo Mosley FBI.
Yeah.
And that he is looking for a counterfeiter and sends De Niro around the back to open up the, they open, one guy opens up the register, and all the little beats he does. Now you take one step back. Now you open the register. And you,
well, to open with, has anybody used any 20s here in basketball hour? 20s. Not like hundreds or somehow like, at the end, when he actually shows thousands, and I've never seen a $1,000 bill up close. I know we used to print them, but we stopped a long time ago. 20s, though, is so great, because, of course, the answer is yes.
Yes.
So, yeah. Oh, shit.
Yeah, that's it. I think this is it. And he looks over like what some old guy said in the bar.
That's an improv. It has to be.
You see any suspicious people around here?
You seen any suspicious-looking characters around here?
No.
Do you live around here?
Yeah.
With the wait between the, have you seen these suspicious people too? Do you live around here? You're just kind of looking at him for a little while and looking around. Do you live around here? Kind of thing. It's unnecessarily long.
Well, the slowness of what Grodin does, that's why I go back to like, I didn't want to see Robin Williams in this part.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't do these things. He
the
can't.
Subtlety of it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Or even like they ask him who passed this penny to $20 bill. Was the guy 6 feet?
6'5".
Dark brown hair.
Light colored.
Sounds like our man.
That's him.
Sounds like our man.
But just the back and forth of that, he's goading a tall guy, like 6 foot, 6'5". dark brown hair, just the immediate, yeah. Like, that confirms.
Yeah.
Once you say 6'5", you've already set the ceiling at 6 foot and be like, no, I meant 6'5". We all know that I meant 6'5". Dark brown hair. What's no, so it was actually light, sounds like our man.
It makes me think about Jonathan Mardoukas because he has shown two brilliant performances.
Oh, yeah.
One on the airplane and one now. And really what he's done is like, this is the way I don't know any of this, but the way I put it in my brain is that he was a completely normal middle of the road guy. But now that he's basically outside the law, he has given himself permission to be this person that he had, you know what I mean?
Well, he has nothing to lose.
Nothing to lose.
He's literally nothing to lose. Because worst case scenario is he dies and he already knows that.
He's going, and they get up to 20s. They head out. They have some groceries. They see a train. We're running for the train. Again, he's trying to resist running for the train in the same way he's trying to risk getting on the plane. Yet he manages to jump on the plane and closes the door on De Niro, yelling, "See you in the next life."
Yeah, he jumps on the train. Yeah. Oh, and the guy sees him from the bar. The guy sees them from the bar. Yeah, so he makes the call. What do they call you? Red.
Red.
Do you dye your hair?
No.
His name is Bill Wood. And it's Red's Corner Bar.
It's such a random fucking
name. You expect Groden to do a follow-up on that, and he just kind of goes, it's not worth my time.
Yeah, right.
It's so good. The little mental calculation you see behind his eyes, because he's wanted to play with everybody else that he's coming into contact with. He's like, no, it's not worth it.
The fruit's hanging too low on this.
Exactly, exactly. It's not worth the effort. Yeah.
So the Duke is in the train, has closed the door. Jack jumps on the train, climbs up over the top, and comes down to the other side with the line.
Glad to see me. Oh, my God. I don't know why that line always gets it. It's the angle that he's at. It's the anger in his voice. Oh, it's just great. Yeah, well, Groden is like immediately like, oh, okay, Jack, calm down.
Is this our next life? He says that to him when he closes the door.
Yeah. And now you see the full rage.
Yeah.
It comes out and finally ends up, I'm not talking to you for the whole rest of the trip. And we're back.
He's hurt. Jack is hurt. It's not a matter.
They've helped each other. He thinks that there's a camaraderie there.
They did have a moment in the bar.
They did.
Yes. I mean,
they really did.
And he still.
And they have saved each other's lives.
Right.
And you think that there's something there, but I got to give you the slip at some point.
And of course, now we have Marvin and Alonzo again.
I'm telling you, I don't know anything.
Is that a fact?
Oh, shit.
And again, he takes his cigarettes.
Why don't you quit? It'd be cheaper for both of us.
Yeah.
And this came from the fact that someone kept bumming. I don't think it was Yaphet Kotto. I think George Gallo kept bumming cigarettes at the bar, and John Ashton said that in a bar.
Wow.
And they went, well, we got to put this into the movie. And that's how that bit got created, which is a great little bit.
Great line.
And now we find out that an agent, Alonzo Mosley, hopped a train in Arizona or New Mexico or wherever. We're on the train at night, and Charles Grodin's having a conversation with himself.
Jack? What? Which further do you think we have to go? None of your fucking business. No, because, you know, eventually I'm going to have to go to the bathroom. Shut the fuck up.
And then Groden says,
do you ever have sex with an animal, Jack? Remember those chickens around the Indian reservation? There's some good-looking chickens there, Jack. You know, between us.
Yeah, a couple of them might have taken a shot at.
That's great, though.
It's really funny.
Having the back and forth, and eventually Jack just goes, let's talk.
So here's the story behind this.
Oh, shit, there's a story?
Yes. So they had the scene where he was furious on him. I'm not talking to you for the rest of the trip. And then in the script, the next bit of line is when they start talking about the watch. Why didn't you tell me about that watch? And you told me when you get to know me better and all that stuff. And they have this really nice scene. And they try to do the scene, and it just doesn't work. And the reason it just doesn't work is because the emotional place we left the characters can't get to here. Mm-hmm. And De Niro finally just stopped talking. He's like, I'm not going to respond. You have to earn this moment. And Martin Brest said to Charles Grodin, like, I don't know what to do, but you have to get him to talk to you.
Yeah.
And so the first thing he came up with was this, he's going to have the argument with himself. And then the chicken thing is an improv. And when he came up with the chicken thing, and De Niro started laughing and said, yeah, a couple of those I might take a shot at. Then they went on with the scene,
right.
You know? And it's actually a great lesson, I think, in all sorts of ways is that first of all, you have to honor the emotional place you were in before. You can't skip over it.
Yeah.
And second of all, you really have to, you can't fake earn a moment in a scene. You have to actually earn it. you know? So having putting up this big obstacle and making this guy overcome it, the actor overcome it, that just totally works.
It feels emotionally organic. It has to feel emotionally organic, and the audience knows.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then we find out, now we're talking about the watch, and that Gale bought him the watch, and that it's always 30 minutes fast because he was always late.
I forgot about this moment. Yeah. I forgot what the watch's significance was till I saw the film again.
Somewhere in the back of my mind, I keep thinking we're going to wind up together again. I don't know why. I'm still hanging on. I'm still waiting around.
I don't think she's coming back.
Yeah, I don't either.
Sometimes you just have to let go. Just get yourself a new watch.
It's really powerful because he says to him, I don't think she's coming back. He's holding on to the watch thinking that she's going to come back someday. And, and he says, like, real matter-of-factly, and not to hurt him, he's just saying it in a way of, like, affection or friendship. Like, I don't think she's coming back, and you got
to
let go.
Yeah, if you're going to grow as a person,
yeah,
you need to let certain things, you know, die.
And get a new watch.
That hit me, man. That was a good line. It hit me this
sometimes
time.
You got to get a new watch.
Yeah. Especially at the end when they have that closing scene he gives him the watch and you're like, wow, the significance of that for him.
Yeah.
And he's taking Groden's advice too, that I need to move on.
Yeah.
And I gave your watch away. You grow with this now. Like give it a good home.
Yeah.
And I love too, there's a nice pause and a very companionable moment. And then he says,
"You're okay, Jack. I think under different circumstances, you and I probably still would have hated each other."
And I think that's a great way to go with the scene.
Yep.
And then Jack says, "No, maybe we could have been friends."
Yeah.
And we get to in the next life. Yeah. In the next life. Marvin leaves the cops and we're back on the train. And we think we kind of made it to Arizona. And so that means we're almost there. To which Groden's response is, "I'm almost dead."
Hmm.
And he's kind of going, look, witness protection isn't so bad.
I'm not
going
to make it to any witness protection program.
You don't know that, John.
I know that. You know that. Serrano's going to get to me before I get to any witness protection program. Do me a favor. Don't pretend you care about me. It really insults my intelligence. I mean, let's face it. The only important thing about me to you is getting your money.
It's interesting because in Jack's mind, he's like, well, Serrano offered me $1 million. If I only cared about the money, I would have taken that.
Right.
And then again, he lets one little piece of information slip. The reason I do this shit in the first place was because I wouldn't work for that low life asshole. Well, what does that mean? Nothing. And he tries the same thing that happens over and over again. I let something slip. You know, the Duke sees a way in and then he tries to shut it down. But then it ends up that, you know, he's given him enough and Groden figures out, oh,
Serrano is the heroin dealer you told me about in Chicago? Who owned your buddies and destroyed your life? That's Serrano? That's the guy that you're taking me in? That's the guy that's going to kill me? I hope it's a wonderful coffee shop, Jack.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Just a guilt trip.
Yeah.
Once he realizes the commonality and the moralistic stance you're taking is kind of bullshit.
The train is pulling into the station? Time to jump off the train.
No, I don't want to do it. No.
He pulls him off the train, and there are like a million cops waiting at this station.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the movie has gone into ridiculous land. I mean, there's like, it's a ton of cops, a ton of cop cars.
But I go the other route. If the wife already knows about him in Chicago, these small town, whatever, that's probably the locals, the county.
We got
the FBI, we got everybody. It's just like, this is the best thing going right now.
Right.
We're going to divert all our resources to this. That's what I always took it as. It's just like,
sure.
It's not like it's downtown, you know, LA or something.
Sure. Well, and this is the thing, too. It's like, you know, the truth is, once you have helicopters, you know, it's sort of, you don't need 100 cop cars to know where somebody is. You can just see them. And of course, who else pulls up but Marvin pulls up?
Mm-hmm.
And then I love the little bit of dialogue again where we're walking away from the train.
The trains have regularly scheduled stops. The reason for that is, you know, because people plan to get off the trains when they stop. And that's how generally people do it. They don't like throw each other off the trains. That's the purpose of having stops.
Jack hotwires some truck, which is a great truck with a sawed-off top. He's committing a lot of crimes to get this guy.
Yeah, he is. Numerous.
Yeah. And we get in the truck. We're going to get to the nearest airport. They're driving along, and then we see a cop car. and then another cop car.
Shit.
And then Alonzo gets the radio call that they're near Sedona, which I've been to. It's very beautiful. Very beautiful area.
Looks like they've been spotted around 35 miles south of here near Sedona. There are officers in pursuit. Let's take the chopper.
Marvin sees all the cop cars pull out. What's going on here? And Jack is dodging cop cars, three cop cars, four cop cars, helicopters coming, a fleet of cars is coming. Jack is driving through traffic. John is screaming.
God damn it, I don't like this.
John gives him this amazing, amazing dirty look. Marvin's just following that line of cop cars. Jack stops in the middle of the road. Cars and helicopters coming from in front of him, from behind him. Drives into the woods. This is the desperate move. And I love this part of the movie. I just think this is a this is such an 80s sort of action sequence, you know? This kind of a thing.
Where are you going, Jack? We'll find out when we get there.
And the cops fall into the woods. And Jack is muttering to himself, I've come too far, too far.
Yeah.
I'm too close. And I was thinking as I was watching, it's like, oh yeah, this is the kind of movie where you just wreck a lot of cop cars.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of 80s movies where you just wreck a lot of cop cars.
Oh yeah.
Like Blues Brothers. You just, we're going to wreck a lot of cars.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're cheap, all things considered, and adds production value. So.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because today you're going to do some big CGI chasing.
But it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's crazy explosion, stupidness happens over here to distract the eye and give a sense of urgency within the scene.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and there's like, you know, cars crashing into cliffs and into trees and down rocks and flipping over, and they finally crash the car into a tree, and helicopters flying over and sees all these wrecked cop cars, and I do not understand why the helicopter just completely loses them. It just doesn't make any sense at all. Marvin gets off the road. Jack and John are like hiding behind a bush. And they walk up the dirt road, and here comes a car. Oh, good. We're saved. There's a car. They flag it down. And then this moment of, wait, is that Marvin? And I love John Ashton.
Am I lucky or am I just good?
Is that Marvin?
Fucking A, I'm the best.
And then we get the car door gag.
Yeah, once again.
Which looks really painful.
Hell yeah, it does. He's definitely broken a rib at some point.
Yeah. And grabs the Duke. See you in L.A., Jack. And Marvin drives away. Jack is hurt. No sign of the helicopters, the cops,
right?
All of that has disappeared. Jack has got the sad music and the lonely walk down the road and into some roadside diner. What's the guy behind the counter? It's he's tons of stuff.
He was in Batman, in the 1989 Batman. He was Bob. Yeah.
Yes,
he was his henchman.
Yeah, he was.
Right,
that guy's in a million things, a
ton of things. And there's just, you know, this is the thing. This movie's populated with great character actors. Yeah. And we have a little cup of coffee, a little smoke, some sunglasses slide down, and there's Alonzo.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, I've been looking all over for these. Thanks, Alonzo.
We get to the airport, and the Duke's saying, Marvin, I have a very, very serious fear of flying. And he says, well, just sleep on it. Punches him.
Yeah, takes care of the problem right then and there.
Jack wants a phone call. Calls Jerry, put Eddie on.
This better be good news, fucking Jack, because you got 5 hours left.
No, it's not, Eddie. I'm calling to let you know, though, that you're a dead motherfucker. You understand me?
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
You put Marvin on this case, you fucking piece of shit.
You fucking deceptive. You vermin. You
are you fucking you done yet?
You slam ball in a sea of pus.
You
what?
He's just yelling at Eddie.
Eddie, what are you fucking talking about?
Look, you got 5 hours left. Can you bring the fucking Duke in, yes or no?
I thought he's bringing him to you.
I just talked to fucking Dorfler. He don't have the Duke.
What?
Where's the fucking Duke? Hello?
I'll talk to you later.
And this is when suddenly something clicks. Wait, I thought Dorfler was bringing him in. Jack hangs up, thinks, looks in his pocket, finds the matchbooks that he got given by Tony, who's moron number one. Calls it, asks for Tony.
Tony Darville there, please.
Who's calling?
Marvin Dorfler.
Marvin. Everything's still on schedule, pal, isn't it?
So Dorfler's working for you guys.
And now Jack's starting to have a plan.
So what the fuck are you telling me for?
What am I telling you for? What am I telling you for? I'll tell you what I'm telling you for. I got some of the Duke's belongings, that's why, including some computer disks that have every last detail of Serrano's businesses and his money laundering operations, everything.
If I don't get the Duke back in the
next 2 hours, I'm going to turn those discs over to the feds.
Meet me at McLaren Airport, which is Las Vegas, and you give the Duke and I give the discs. And now he tells Alonzo that he has something he wants to make a deal.
What would you do if I could deliver you Serrano?
What do you mean, deliver?
For starters, conspiracy to destroy government evidence.
What government evidence?
Will you let me take the Duke back myself and collect my money?
And I love that the music hits then, because that tells you that Alonzo's already going to agree.
Tell me more.
Well, I'll have to tell you on the way, because we got to be in Las Vegas in 2 hours.
Marvin's got a great idea in the motel. He hands a nice USA Today or something to the Duke, takes a picture to prove that he's got him at the right time. And while we're on the plane, and Jack is describing the plan.
If he just sets foot inside the airport, he's committed an overt act, conspiracy to obstruct justice. When he shows up with the Duke, you add kidnapping. Anybody packing a gun, conspiracy to commit murder. The fact that it's an airport. And Alonzo, correct me if you think I'm wrong here. I don't want to step on your toes. You can slap an interstate transportation aid or racketeering rap on him right away as well.
And he rolls off a whole bunch of crimes.
Yeah.
And I love the glee that De Niro does this with, because you can see he was a really good cop.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually loves this.
Mm-hmm.
He's feeling great about this. And Yaphet Kotto's response is,
get a wire on this man.
Marvin meets Tony and Joey, our two morons,
mm-hmm.
and he wants to ask for more money. Give me the million now, I'll go get the Duke, and you give me the second million later. And Tony punches him out.
Mm-hmm.
Because in
Why'd you do that? Why'd you do that?
Yeah.
You lost our only lead.
Because you look at the picture, and in the Polaroid, there is the name of the motel that the Duke is at.
Right. Yeah, the Blue Angel Motel.
That's a really classy place, by the way. I stay there every time I'm in Vegas.
It looks like it.
Really nice.
I like that initial scene when he takes the hostage photo, because he's so proud of himself. And he's like, I impress so even myself sometimes. And then you're like, well, you left the name of where you're staying back there, genius.
So in the original script, they were supposed to kill Marvin. He dies in that scene.
Oh, shit.
I don't know, because it's one person who I was listening to said the studio had said, you can't kill Marvin. And George Gallo, the screenwriter, says, hey, I don't think we can kill Marvin. And Martin Brest said, you're right. We like him too much.
Yeah.
We can't kill him. And they said, you have to come up with an ending where Marvin's not dead. And so the whole confrontation that we're about to see at the airport, that's a rewrite. And apparently Gallo was very close to being fired because he couldn't figure out how to include Marvin at the end.
Hmm. Oh,
and looking
shit.
At it now, I can't understand how he couldn't have.
Yeah.
Because we are arriving at the airport. Jimmy is heard that he's going to make a deal with the Duke, and he is setting up to kill, as soon as he gets the disc, he's going to kill the Duke and kill Jack.
Yeah.
We have the FBI putting a wire on Jack, who's smiling now because he feels like a cop again. We have the Duke being brought in a limousine. He's at the airport. And we have our first conversation with Jimmy and the Duke.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that this is the first time they've met.
So I'm finally in the presence of greatness, huh? The Duke.
And then he says, I'm gonna tell you two things.
Number one is that you're gonna die tonight. Number two, I'm gonna go home, have a nice hot meal. I'm gonna find your wife, and I'm gonna kill her too.
That is scary.
Yeah, I always assumed he was gonna threaten violating his wife and then kill her.
Yeah.
That was my expectation the first time I saw it.
Mm.
I guess to give Farina's character a little bit of humanity, because this is a comedy after
sure, that makes him really sympathetic.
Well, but doing the one and then the other
compounds
it to a degree that makes it the individual heinous.
As
if killing isn't already heinous enough. You guys know what I'm saying.
It's uber heinous. Jack is waiting in the airport. We got cops watching, we got Alonzo watching, we got mob guys watching. It seems like everybody in this airport is on it.
Especially when it breaks finally.
Yeah.
There's like 700 FBI agents.
So
like out of nowhere, everybody, all the ticket agents, the passengers, like, Jesus, how many man hours is this guy worth?
I even saw a baggage handler got upset because he didn't get in there quick enough.
And we got finally Dennis Farina and Robert De Niro having a conversation. The scene's great.
It's terrible. Mm. He's terrible to him.
Yeah.
He says the most horrific things.
Insulting his clothes.
Well, yeah, but then...
Brings up his wife.
She left you with a blah, blah, blah. It must suck.
Another guy who was on the take. That doesn't drive you nuts that guy is now fucking your wife?
Yeah, dude.
Since we have this moment to share together, there's something I've been meaning to ask you. The
Doesn't it bother you that another copper is fucking your wife? You know they made this guy a captain?
And, of course, Alonzo and the FBI guys are going, just give him the disc.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
give him the disc.
Just give him the disc.
And the conversation is going on because he doesn't want to give him the disc until he sees the Duke. Right. That's what he wants, which means the FBI guys really don't care about whether Mardukas gets killed. They don't care about that at all.
Which is weird because he would only bolster their case.
Right.
Losing him doesn't help them. Keeping him alive. So why wouldn't you wait for the exchange? Because right now, all you're going to lose is a bounty hunter.
Yeah.
Right. That's the worst you're going to lose.
Right. But the stress is getting worse. I love Yafet's line.
This thing is going to give me a heart attack before it's all over. I'm coming. I know I'm going to get a heart attack.
And then in come finally, they do bring in the Duke. And just as we're about to make an exchange, who should show up but Marvin? Because this is the solution that he came up with. Marvin is just there to get his plane ticket home. And the guy who's working the ticket counter?
Martin Brest.
Is Martin Brest.
Yep.
Okay.
Which I never knew. I never knew that because I didn't know what he looked like. And there's a great, the line, smoking or non-smoking, that's a Martin Brest ad-lib. To which John Ashton has the perfect perfect response.
What do you think?
And he pulls off and he goes after the situation because he's so put upon the whole movie that finally he thinks he's going to get he's going to win. Like Marvin does in this moment.
Because he spots Jack and goes, spots the Duke.
He spots the Duke.
He spots the Duke first.
Yeah, it goes,
I'm gonna
this.
I'm gonna figure this out.
Doesn't know who Jimmy Serrano looks like, apparently. And goes up and the discs have just gotten exchanged. And Serrano's going, who the fuck are you?
Who the fuck are you? Are you writing a book? Who the fuck are you?
And he's going, Jack, get out of here. And he pushes Jack and his hand slaps on his clothes and that knocks out the wire.
Wire's gone dead.
So even though Serrano's got the discs, the FBI guys don't know.
Yeah.
Because he pulls the discs out of Jack's hands and Jack's going, Serrano's got the discs. Yeah. Serrano's got the discs.
Serrano's got the discs. Let him go, Jack. Serrano's got the discs. Did he not take the discs?
I couldn't tell. There's too much going on down there.
Serrano's got the discs. He's got the discs.
And now he's yelling.
Serrano's got the disc!
And basically, you're right. Everyone in this airport is like
five people.
Turns into like a sketch.
Yep.
Like a flash mob. And then suddenly everybody's dancing around. You're like, what the fuck is this?
Yep. And De Niro walks up to Serrano and says,
Jimmy, there's something I've been wanting to say to you for 10 years.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
You're under arrest.
Alonzo says, we still got a deal? We got a deal. And John doesn't know what's going on.
What's going on?
Sorry, John. I got an hour and a half to get you back that late.
And now we're on the plane. Jack's smoking on the plane. That's what you do, looking at the watch. And there's just a great look from Charles Grodin there. Off the plane, he cuffs Grodin. We get past that welcome to Los Angeles sign. He calls Eddie on the payphone.
Well, where the hell are you?
Where am I? I'm at the airport.
And guess who I'm with? I'm with the Duke.
You got him! You got him, Jack! I love you!
Yeah, you want to say hello?
Yeah, put him on.
Yeah, say hello.
Hello.
Hello, you son of a bitch! We got you, you son of a bitch!
Yeah. Now say goodbye, you lying little piece of shit, because I'm letting them go.
And there's just a great look from Grodin.
Which is what he promised him when he saved him out of the water. He was going to let him go.
Yeah.
So he did eventually let him go.
Yeah. But he also did lie to him first.
Well, yeah, you know.
Would have been a nice coffee shop.
Oh, jeez. Oh, I don't get it.
I do what I wanted to do, John. I got you to L.A. before midnight, so...
I don't know what to say.
Don't say anything. Knowing you, you'll make me want to put those back on you again.
And for the first time, the Duke is at a loss for words. I don't know what to say.
Thanks.
No, John, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's when he takes off the watch and gives him the watch.
Something to remember our adventure by.
Jack.
And then he says, you know what? I got something for you. And he kind of goes like, come closer. Come closer.
He does it like a child.
Yeah.
Mm. He like ponies up next to the telephone.
Like the telephone booth, yeah.
And he's almost hiding between the two. He's like, come here. Come here. Just like under his breath, like make motion because I don't want to. You don't know why. Yeah. And obviously the reason, you know, 300K, I would be kind of sheepish about that as well. But it's a really nice moment they have between the two of them.
And he pulls out this money belt and hands it to him.
Which is had the whole...
The whole time.
Frickin' time.
Which he said, I have money.
Yeah.
He did say it. He didn't lie about it.
Nope.
When I was making my getaway, I thought the FBI was closing in on me. Take it. Take it.
I took some traveling, Gotti. Take it. Take it. It's not a payoff. It's a gift. You already let me go. You son of a bitch. You son of a bitch.
I wish you had money.
I know you had money. I didn't know you had money.
Yeah.
And we see this filled with $1,000 bills, which, by the way, are hard to get. Karen was working on a movie once, and she had to get a bunch of $1,000 bills. And you have to, there are not a lot of them around, and you have to get, like, pay insurance on them. And
wow.
Yeah, because
yeah, we stopped making them a long time ago.
Yeah, they're hard to get.
Who's on the $1,000 bill?
I don't know.
Steve, what the fuck, man?
who guesses on the $1,000 bill?
Andrew Jackson?
No, he's on the 20.
I used to know this. Damn it.
It's got to be something weird, like like FDR or something.
Millard Fillmore?
Sure. Why not? Taft?
I want to find out.
Who's on the $1,000 bill? Because we stopped making that, I would assume, maybe right around this time, if not a little bit before this. Because hundreds are easier to track. And I think that's part of the reason we shifted over to hundreds.
Yeah, I don't know who it's on.
Plus, I don't know how much use there is for $1,000 bills, especially in the digital world.
It seems like a silly thing to carry around.
Yeah, well, we're still making the penny, you know?
And that's definitely silly.
Well, it costs us, what, like 1.5 cents to make a penny, so we lose money.
Waste so much.
Grover Cleveland.
It's Grover Cleveland?
Grover Cleveland.
On the 1,000.
Wow.
Okay.
Of all people,
Grover fucking Cleveland.
I want to say he was a pro-business president, so not surprising.
It's the only president to be elected non-sequentially.
Oh, is he the one? I knew there
was
one.
Yeah, he was elected and then took 4 years off and then elected again.
Yep. So weird. William McKinley's on the $500 bill.
And there was a $10,000 bill, too.
James Madison is on the $5,000. And you're right. Salmon P. Chase.
Salmon
is on
P. Chase. $10,000.
Wow. Not even a president.
Was namesake of, he had to be the FDR.
Oh,
he's namesake
bank. Chase. Yeah, probably.
He's Secretary of the Treasury under Lincoln.
Yes, he is.
Oh, okay.
He's in Team of Rivals, which is a great book.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Doris Kearns Goodwin, yes.
Okay.
Wow.
So we did some vamping to give John time to find it, and now we've got some. Look, this has been your currency show.
Yeah. The $100,000 bill is the one that had Woodrow Wilson.
Oh.
$100,000.
I mean, why? Who are you trying to show off to?
Yeah, well, there's not huge cartels. And how big is like a kidnapping going to get outside of the Lindbergh baby? That you're going to need a $100,000 bill.
Gentlemen, we've almost reached the end.
Oh, sorry.
Have
you never been on the top 10 shows?
How often does this come up, man? You had information on it, so this is partly your fault.
I feel like we're almost at the end of a midnight run. Like, we've just made it. Like, we're right at L.A.
Dude, you know. It's hard to take it. The dealer gets us hooked on the drugs and then gets upset when we want more of the drugs. It's a little pious.
That's a good analogy.
It's a little pious, isn't it? It works beautifully anyway.
In their last moment, they say,
see you in the next life. See you in the next life.
And Jack turns and looks at the door, turns around. And he pulled a Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Duke is gone. He goes outside the airport, asks what time it is, finds out that he had 25 minutes and he would have made it.
Yeah.
Now all he's got to do is get a cab. Got change for $1,000?
What are you, a comedian? Get out of here, you bum.
Looks like I'm walking.
And the music comes up. He walks away. And we've reached the end of Midnight Run. So I don't have a lot about the reception. It did really well.
Yeah.
It was a very well-loved comedy. It did great in home video. It wasn't nominated for things. So, you know, normally there's like lots of talk of what happened next, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah. I mean, a comedy in that era now, it got nominated at the Golden Globes. Like, it was one of the better comedies of the year kind of thing. And actually, the Globes really just want famous people to show up. But at that time, it's like, it was a comedy and we're moving on.
Yeah. So, John, do you have final thoughts on Midnight Run?
Yeah, I would say if this is a hole in your resume of film watching from the 80s, right? 80, 88, 88. 89? Yeah, this is definitely one you need to fill in because it's an enjoyable time and it's 2 hours and 6 minutes. It's not a short film for this kind of film, but it's full of a lot of interesting humor, a really well-done script, and some fun acting all around from all the actors in this film. And it's a subtle comedy. There's laugh-out-loud moments, but they're coming from subtle jokes. They're not coming from big, huge punchlines, which is great. And it's littered with incredible characters, and even the small characters in every scene have life to them, and that's what you would want if you're going to take this trip. And I think it's a very enjoyable film, and you should totally go back and watch it.
What do you think, Matt?
I don't know what I have to add to that. That was pretty succinct. I think if they've listened to us, they've heard our radio play version, and it was, you know, it was not bad. There you go. I would hope you would have seen it, or hopefully, like, when people see the title for the show, they actually watch the movie and then listen to this.
It seems about split.
Sometimes people
watch the, go, okay, I know it's coming, and watch the movie, and sometimes people wait till after.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just a movie you always said to yourself, I don't want to see that, and they hear the discussion, they're like, wow, that movie sounds really good, except for we just literally spoiled the entire thing.
Some people are into that. It's weird.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are so many movies out there that it's inevitable that some of them are going to get spoiled.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, once a movie's literally 30 years old, which is this one. Oh, and this is actually the 30th anniversary. Yeah, I hadn't been thinking about it.
Wow.
For me, it's funny. We've on the show for a while. We've done some heavy movies lately. Like last time we saw Robert De Niro was in Taxi Driver on the Cinephiles.
Right.
And we spent a lot of time talking about deep stuff and why is this film important and what does it say about philosophy and politics and living in the modern world and all of these things. And I was thinking about this movie and I don't think this has anything particular to say. I don't think this is important. I don't think this is deep. I think this movie is totally fun.
Yes.
And I think in all of the deep conversations that we've had sometimes, it's possible that sometimes we lose track of the fact that movies are about entertainment. And the reason you go to see a movie above anything else is to be entertained. And if you're going to get some deep stuff, that's fine too. But there is something wonderful about watching a movie with people really at the top of their game. Great comedy chops being showed by Robert De Niro, an unbelievably funny performance from Charles Grodin, an incredible cast of supporting actors, a score from Danny Elfman I loved, and a movie that is actually just a really, really fun ride. So that's what we think of Midnight Run. Of course, we always want to hear what you think. You can reach us on our Facebook page. Just do a search for The Cinephiles. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and YouTube and a whole bunch of other places. If you're on iTunes, leave us a review. If you're on YouTube, hey, leave us a comment. We love to hear it. If you want to support us, you can visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/thecinephiles, where you can pick one of the movies that we review. And as always, you can reach me on Twitter at SR Morris. John, where can they reach you?
Oh, you guys can always reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter and on Instagram and see all the stuff I'm doing there.
And Matt, are you reachable on these interwebs?
Sure, it's at Matt Knost, MattKnost.
And if you haven't listened to the Top 10 show ever, and maybe listening to Matt and I do a little repartee here, maybe that inspired you to go find us. You can find us on the Schmoes No Network, the Top 10 show, and just to go and subscribe to that feed, and then you'll get our show
every Tuesday at midnight.
Every Tuesday
Pacific Standard Time.
Yeah. It is a fabulous show. I subscribe to it, and I am also on a patron on Patreon.
Yes, you are. You're at the $5 level for shout out. Thank you for that every month.
You're very, very welcome.
You got your shout out today. How did it feel? I've never been in the room with somebody who's got their shout out.
I haven't listened to it yet.
Oh my gosh.
I heard the last time you shouted out to me, and I liked it very much.
Roughly the same, I believe this time.
It's about the same.
Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's been great having you.
It sounds like you guys do heavy shit every week. And this week you're like, let's invite the clown on.
No.
We'll do a clown movie.
That's not true at all.
Where is Mueller getting in the bottom of your emails? I want to see these guys. I want to see the behind the scenes. No, thank you for having me. It's been far too long. We've talked about it amongst the two of us, and having you on our show as well, which will happen eventually.
Yeah.
I'm not sure when. He can show you the list of whatever.
Probably very soon, I would imagine. Yeah.
I'm available.
Absolutely. We'll make it happen.
We'll have some people call people and we'll work it out.
It'll happen over the next 2 months. I can promise that.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a little tease right there.
Well, hey-o.
Cool. Well, I think that is it for this week, and we will see you next time on The Cinephiles.